Call to order the meeting, regular study session of the City Council. Roll call, Council members Ward, Townsend, Blossom, Tollefson, Bonkowski, Blair, and Roth in attendance, full council. A motion to accept or modify the agenda. Mr. Bonkowski?
I'd like to add an item under council discussion to talk about signage in the folding signs.
Yeah. Sometimes moved and seconded. This is a sandwich board.
Sandwich board thing,
sign
yeah.
Ordinance.
Sign ordinance, okay. I have a second.
Anne got it.
We have a motion to...
I was going
to
move we approve the agenda as modified.
Is there a second for that motion?
Second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Proceeding to the first item number three, the city manager's report.
In the city manager's report that went out last Friday, we had additional information on some of the projects occurring this construction season. We also had an article regarding information about the police facility and ongoing discussions related to that issue, which you'll hear more about this evening. We also included information about this is something that came out of our high-performance organization staff input. We're creating or have created a COBE green team, and that team will be working on various projects and bring forth ideas that will help identify priority areas where we can look at low-cost, no-cost changes to increase efficiency and conservation. Then Public Works update, we had fire flow testing, or coming up this Wednesday we'll start fire flow testing. There will be signs placed in those areas where that will be occurring. Eagle Harbor Sewer Beach Mains update, we anticipate construction starting tomorrow on that and lasting through mid-October. And then we had information welcoming our newest city employee, Kelly Eisenhood, who is a new police clerk with the police department. And then information on upcoming events. Probably most important right now is the meeting tomorrow evening, Navigate Bainbridge. That's the kickoff for the comprehensive plan process. This first meeting is Comprehensive Plan 101, and we're very fortunate to have Joe Tovar coming as the speaker for that meeting tomorrow night. That's all I have.
Questions?
One of the questions has come up is there on the agenda, there's no public comment on tomorrow night. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct.
Okay, that's
the agenda does have a panel discussion. There will be a Q&A with Mr. Tovar as well as a panel discussion followed. Part of that will be a Q&A as well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Let's move on to item 4A, police facilities planning. Morgan.
Good evening, Council. Tonight we wanted to update you on the next steps that we have sketched out for continuing our work to understand our options for locating a police facility. At the June 16th meeting, I think you'll recall, Mackenzie presented the results of two pieces of work they did on our behalf. One was the final report on the facility assessment of the current station and their assessment of the requirements and initial cost estimates for both a combined facility with fire and a standalone facility. And then also on June 16th, they talked with us about some initial feasibility work they had done to look at potential sites for a standalone facility. And at that meeting, Council's request was that we keep the ball rolling and go ahead and sketch out what we thought needed to happen next to get to a decision point. And so we brought that forward for your consideration tonight. The memo that's in your packet talks a little bit about what we see as important next pieces of information to be able to get to the same level of understanding about all of the options that exist or that have emerged, I guess, as best alternatives. And just to remind you, at this point, we are focusing our attention on two options that involve locations near City Hall. So those would have the benefit of being near to other city functions, but also providing an in-town location. And then the alternative to that, and I'll just to be specific, we ruled out essentially as not very workable the idea that there might be an opportunity to the east of City Hall. We felt like based on the results from Mackenzie that there's not enough room to provide adequate police facilities and access and ingress and egress with the configuration out here. But we're still interested in understanding the potential for a location to the south of City Hall and a facility to the north of City Hall. So when we talk about our in-town options, we're talking about those two alternatives at this point. And then, of course, what we understand probably to a little bit lower level of specificity is what a combined facility would look like. And that's because Mackenzie, as part of that initial project, took that analysis to a more specific level of detail. So we have some very good information, a high degree of certainty that there's a feasible project that we can build in conjunction with fire at the Station 21 site. What we want to do is take these in-town options and bring them to the same level of assessment so that we understand that we can confirm that they are, in fact, feasible options for us. And then, in addition to that, Mackenzie, as we have scoped out, would take us through a facilitated site ranking process. So assuming that all three of those options are actually viable and can be done and can achieve the goals that we have in terms of the space requirements, the parking requirements, the access, what the site ranking process would let us do is have a standardized, facilitated process to take those options and understand what are the pros and cons with each of them. So that's a process that's been identified and established by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. It's one that McKenzie has used in other communities. They have done this exercise of helping communities through that process multiple times. In your packet is an example of what the results look like for a city, I think that's Hillsborough, that they did that work with. So that would be another outcome of this next stage of fact-finding. A third piece that's not, I realize today, isn't really represented in this memo, but a third thing that we're going to be working on in August is, alongside this, we are going to be, within our own police department, doing some data analysis to understand some very community-specific aspects. One is, what are the advantages and disadvantages to an in-town location for, in terms of response? Where are our service calls? How does that play into the decision to either locate here or locate further north on Madison? We'd also ask our department to provide some feedback on whether having a community presence in town versus a little bit further away, what are the advantages and disadvantages of that? And then just general access issues. So I think Councilmember Ward raised the question of wanting to hear from our police department, from our police chief, about the benefits or disadvantages of being closer to 305 directly versus having to come through a town. So alongside this work that's described that we'll be doing with McKenzie, we'll be doing our own work on those topics so that what we bring back to you in early September has all the components I think we need to lay the existing alternatives against each other. We'll have the ballpark cost estimates that McKenzie's already developed. We'll have confirmation whether all three of the emerging best options are actually viable, so we'll have that degree of certainty. We'll have the results of this site ranking process, and we'll have the feedback from our department about these more community-specific elements that we want to feather in. And so our plan in terms of timeline is to have that information to bring to a study session in September. I would like to aim for the second study session in September because the first study session is right after Labor Day. It's a little bit of a, it would be a little bit of a push to make sure we got our packet materials all assembled for that, but we could certainly say that we were aiming to bring back that information in mid-September, and at that point I expect Council may begin to really dig into decision making.
Questions from the Council?
Thank you. Excuse me. In the memo that you gave to us, you talk often a couple or three times about the participants working on the survey with McKenzie. Who are those participants?
Well, I'm sure Doug can weigh in, but I will tell you that typically McKenzie, that has been a team that consists of police department representatives, city administration representatives, but also and McKenzie staff, because they are technical experts in the area. But then I think there's also the opportunity to potentially include other stakeholders.
Okay, and I guess the reason then hearing that you were also going to do an internal COBE an internal analysis with members of the police department, that seems a bit redundant looking at the kinds of questions. It's not?
So the questions probably do touch on some of the same areas, but I think it's important for us to know specific data about, for example, service calls.
Right.
That's where our calls come from. Here's where we're responding to. So that's the police work that we'll be doing. It's not an intention to have the police department do their own ranking of the sites and say which they prefer.
Okay. Other questions from the council? Mr. Ward.
So the rough order of magnitude difference between a standalone facility and a joint facility is around $2 million from the city's perspective. Do we have any sense of what savings is, if any, from the police or from the fire department's perspective? I'm curious if there's any sort of incentive for them to do that that might positively influence the land costs.
You know, I don't know off the top of my hand or top of my head what a standalone Station 21 cost is, but it's likely to be in that report. So that would be the differential to them, would be the difference between a standalone Station 21 and the $9 million roughly that was identified as their share of a shared building. But I can certainly go into the report and look and see.
Yeah, I'd love to know that figure.
I'll follow up
with
that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Bonkowski.
This is a really great presentation. The question I have is, based on the analysis that you're doing, it sounds like you're evaluating standalone facilities in the downtown area and a combined facility outside of the downtown area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious why you didn't while we aren't looking at a standalone facility outside of the downtown area in this, at the same time.
One of the elements of the work that McKenzie did in that parallel city-only research was to do a scan for centrally located sites, parcels, that would have sufficient zoning and sufficient size to support the police facility. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see that packet contains some examples of sites like that. There were a couple of sites that were suggested to the immediate east of 305. We did not put in front of them sites further out, either at the north end or the south end. That was from our perspective, based on our police department's reaction, that once you got outside of sort of the middle, however you define that, of the island, you were going to be impacting service response. So we did look at some non-Winslow parcels to see if anything was feasible and didn't identify any. But we didn't ask them to broaden out to either end of the island.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions from the council? Mr. Tollison?
Do you have any plan in mind to involve solicit any sort of public, non-city administration, non-police department reaction to particularly to the downtown, potential downtown locations?
Well, I think the two places where that would come in at this stage, one would be, and you're right, it will come through the filter of the information that our police department gives us, but one of the dimensions we've asked them to respond to is, what are the benefits, disadvantages of, from a community accessibility, community engagement, community interaction lens of being, having a police department that's downtown versus a police department that's at North Madison. So you're right that they will filter that, but I think as you've seen in the last year, they are very focused on community engagement, and having that sort of accessible footprint is a factor in how they do their business. The other place that it may come in is there's the opportunity to include members of the public in the site selection process if that's something that we decide to do.
Mr. Schultz.
One thing I would add is that there may be an opportunity for some public involvement in actually determining a weighting of the criteria that are identified in the IACP industry standard for site evaluation. If you look through that list, some of those items may be more important to the community than others. So mm-hmm. that could be an opportunity for some public input. But I think the actual evaluation itself, we really want to make sure that that's going to be fact driven, so you have the information that you need to make a decision that is a fairly significant investment for the community and intended to last 40 to 50 years.
Mr. Tollison.
One more. I understand that the sample questionnaires that you gave us are just examples, I think, from other jurisdictions, but the Hillsborough one in particular, I think, had some question mentioning a new police and municipal court facility, and I'm wondering whether or not it's your plan to include any sort of questions involving co-location of the municipal court with the police.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to follow up on what Doug was saying, one of the important things about this IACP is it has the benefit of being a standardized tool, and so other communities have found it useful. We also have the ability to customize it. So in addition to weighting, we could add some specific dimensions that we were interested in. In terms of the whether to influence the score based on the ability to accommodate a municipal court, the nice thing is at this stage, we feel like all of the three options, remaining options that we're focusing on, have a court solution that's possible. And so what we talked about in mid-June, my perspective that I want to share is placing the police station is the big challenge. And any of the three options that we have on the table today actually has more than one solution that would be possible for court. Co-location is one. I believe that at this point we think that it would be feasible to do a combined police court facility in some form in any of these. Now, for example, the north option, in order to be able to accommodate municipal court, that requires more land acquisition than you would have to undertake if you were only placing police. So you can do it. The question is, will you determine that you should do it? So in a way, or is a long way of saying, I'm not sure that that's a differentiating measure, because I think that all three are likely to be able to accommodate court. The question is how much weight you would give that, given that they would all get essentially a check mark.
So I take it that the answer is that there isn't any plan to specifically include the court co-location as a part of this questionnaire that you're going to...
I would say we haven't made that decision yet.
Okay, thank you.
Other comments, questions from the council? Any comments from the public? Please come up, introduce yourself.
Good evening, Council. My name is Andy Marin. I live at 9800 Sands Avenue. As some of you know, I used to spend some time in the City Council in the city, and I have to say, looking at your agenda, the more things change, the more they remain exactly the same. The very first four things in your agenda are items which have been talked about for many, many years. So it's kind of, we're coming back. And I'm here today to talk about the location of the police building, because it's something I spent quite a bit of time on 15 years ago. And I have a couple of comments which I hope may be helpful. First, the factors that I see, this listing of factors, I think are helpful, but I think honestly they I particularly object to the averaging that occurs at the bottom, because the most important thing is the ranking of those factors, and Doug just started with that, because over time the priorities of the city council, and this decision really is not the police, it's the collective wisdom of the seven of you, because you're reflecting the community when you make this decision, and the priority of the city over time has changed. Initially in the 1990s it was put the police and court together. That's a very important issue. And so we did. And another priority was for a long time to have the police with the rest of the city, so that the employees all knew each other. And so when this building was designed, initially the police station was right there. But then the other priority came in, which is cost. And it was simply too expensive at the time to build it there. Otherwise, it would be there today. And so the decision was made to not build it and wait 7 years. Well, it's been 14, but so I mention that to you because, to me, as you all think about this and as you're getting input, the most important thing is for you all to make a decision about what are the most important factors. If it is to have the city all in one place as best you can, then you wouldn't have them try to have them with the fire. You'd have to try to have them with you. And just reflecting on the problems with the police relationship in the last 10 years, perhaps that has something to do with it. I don't know. It's just a factor I would urge you to consider. So the proximity, and factor 10 on that list of factors sort of gets at that. It's called proximity to governmental functions, and I think as subparts of that is proximity to city functions as well as other governmental functions. I have two other points. The next one is when they're looking at factor number one, which is cost, I'm assuming that that's just, that would be a net cost. That is, decisions that are made that you will get will include the net of sales that will occur. For example, when you move out of the existing site, you can sell that corner and you can sell the Suzuki property, which was purchased specifically for police and court building. And therefore, if you co-locate here or someplace else, you'll have a net number that you... So I urge you all to keep that in mind. The last point I want to make is the question about public input. I do think that the public input so far has been pretty minimal for the importance of this decision, and I urge you to reach out in every way you can. In the past, we had citizen committees, even citizen, to help really get the word out and get input to you. But I think it's important, as you know, here we're in the summertime. This has sort of gotten lost. We're now going to have a study that comes and has you making a decision right after Labor Day. I mean, the public's not with this, particularly yet, I don't think. And certainly there has been public input that you've put out, but but to get people engaged, and so that the input you're getting is as best you can to understand what fairly represents the thoughts of the community. I think you should try every way you can to get input. Once those alternatives are fairly out there, so that when you make the decision, you can best reflect the community thinking on this. So thank you.
Thank you. Other comments on this topic? All right. Any response, Morgan? No,
our intent was just to give you an update on our thinking of what will be happening over the next 5 or 6 weeks to see if that matched your expectations and to give you a sense of the timeline. If we have consensus that this is where you'd like to head next, we'll be coming back to you in September with some information that hopefully we can move into some of the meat of the decision making.
Ms. Blossom.
Well, I have to say that I agree with Mr. Marin. I mean, I guess I don't know that I would use this in making a decision. So I don't know if doing this costs a lot and if there's really a purpose or point to do it. That's just what I say.
Well, I hope that council and the community will see that the site ranking is what I think you're referring to. See that as one ingredient. We have a wealth of information that we've developed so far that I don't want us to lose track of. We have a 300-page report from McKenzie that gives down to specs on type of glass and windows of what this facility will look like, what it needs to be able to accommodate, what the spatial requirements are both for the building itself and for the site. What we will come out of in September is we will have taken ourselves all the way, assuming we can come to a decision, all the way through to site selection, essentially, and have initial conceptual design and initial cost estimates to be ready to go on what is a really significant project. So I think the site ranking is a way to bring another point of reference in for how you would decide among these alternatives, but it's not intended to stand alone.
Mr. Bonkowski.
The only thing that I agree both with Sarah and Andy Marin, the only thing I would recommend if we're going to use that kind of an evaluation, that before you even start the evaluation, you establish the weighting. Because having been on panels before, once you have the evaluation, you can change the weighting to give any answer you want. So if you want to make it open and transparent, put the weighting up front before you do any of the evaluation.
I think that we agree about that.
Okay.
Ms. Blair.
And I guess the other is hearing what Mr. Marin had to say and the concerns about the community involvement and community input and that sort of thing. Although it was very clearly done and there were lots of opportunities for that, having gone to some of those, there wasn't a lot of community involvement hearing the McKenzie reports. And a 300-page report, while it certainly serves as a strong basis, it may help if we, as we go back, we review some of the highlights from that report and put those in as context and background, even as we consider what we learn from the conversations and the rankings, that matrix that you've offered. Because I think, again, the more we make sure everybody has an opportunity, again, to hear it and know what we think we know, it helps and reassures everybody and gives greater opportunity for the comments, because I think that's a really important ingredient.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
You have something? Thank you. Mm-hmm. And now we'll have you move on to item 7B, city maintenance of road ends and city-owned trails.
So this is a topic that I hope, if it makes sense, will be joined by Barry Lovelace, our Public Works Director. But the intent is really, there's not an action item here. It's to make you aware of some new activities that we've taken on in Public Works and the operations and maintenance group specifically. These were areas that had emerged in the last year or so as places that the city, in a perfect world, would be doing more than we were able to do in the past or than we organized to do in the past. And specifically, we're talking about how the city attends to its road ends, which I hope everyone is at least familiar with what that is, that set of properties. And then also a little bit later, I want to talk to you about city-owned trails. And so this is really just a report back on items that were in the city's work plan for Public Works to begin to do that we weren't previously doing. And I think it's important for council and the community to know that that's underway and to hopefully have the benefit of seeing where we are beginning to restore some of our maintenance responsibilities that we haven't done previously. So talking first about the road ends, Kelly, I don't know if you can maybe pull up that slide. So the city has more than 60 road ends, sometimes the number's in the 70s, but some of those are up for debate. This Google map, which is not perfect, we are working on getting a GIS city system version of this. This just gives you a feel for where these sites are located and frankly how many there are. So it's quite a set of locations. These are sites that provide public access to the shore. There's a range of what they look and feel like. Some of them are high bank viewing areas. Some of them are no bank actual water access. A few of them actually have parking and have been historically maintained as a higher volume of use. But most of them are intended to be neighborhood points of access for people who are walking or biking or want to have handheld watercraft access points. And so there is a very robust citizen committee that has been working for literally two decades to make sure that these road ends are acknowledged, preserved, protected. And up until now, they have been undertaking what maintenance exists on their own. And over the last year or so, I've been working with them to try and come up with a way that the city could begin to step forward and take on some of that obligation. And so in working with Public Works this year, our plan was to come up with some kind of pilot to take maybe a subset. We talked for a while about a quadrant like Northwest or a half or something like that. But when we came right down to it, Public Works said, you know what, let's just try and do them all. And so this summer, for the first time, they have designated staff that are going around on a quarterly basis to every single one of the road ends on our list. We've left a couple of them off for reasons that I can explain, but for now we're talking about 45 of the 60-ish road ends that are being visited on a quarterly basis. The crew went out and did a first visit at each site. They were also trying to test out our resource forecast, which we were doing the math and Public Works thought it might be good to plan for four man hours every quarter times 45 or 60 begins to add up to real math. We're getting, at this point we think we're at a third of an FTE, which doesn't sound like much, but we don't have so many FTEs and it affects crew shifts and things like that. But the good news is they've gone out to almost all of the ones on the list at this point. The crew has reported back that they've had really good neighborhood support. They've been approached more than once by neighbors who said, thank you for doing this and thank you for helping my neighborhood site be more useful and more aesthetically pleasant. And we're committed to keeping up that maintenance schedule, and I think it's hopefully going to have a maybe small footprint but in a lot of areas. So we're going to keep on with the plan that this is part of our regular maintenance, and I hope that that's something that people can begin to see. I have a couple of pictures. We didn't think ahead to do before pictures, but they wanted to share a couple of shots of road ends where they spent a particularly they thought a little more time than usual to kind of make the trail and the access and the vegetation look the way we'd like it to look. There's one more, I think, along those lines. So you can see how left untended something like this could easily become overgrown. The concept of the public access begins to get a little murky. And so if we want to be maintaining these as amenities for the public, it's important for us to keep maintenance on our regular plans. So I don't know if you have any questions about the road ends before we talk about the trail.
Road end questions? Mr. Tollison?
I'm very impressed with Public Works taking this on, but I'm really disappointed that that there isn't more emphasis on seeing this as a perfect opportunity for community volunteer engagement. We have a road end in our neighborhood. The neighbors, immediate neighbors to the road end, love the road end. Do maintenance. If they knew it was their actual obligation, they'd probably do more maintenance. We've got a wonderful new bench. I expect that that's true on many of the road ends. Obviously, to the extent that that was effectively done, it would have two benefits. It would save the city money, and it would make people feel more engaged with their community, I think. And so I'd at least like to encourage Public Works to evaluate the road ends as they're visiting them as whether or not they're appropriate for this kind of thing. And then, you know, I don't know if it's the road end committee or some other group, but reaching out to community members and seeing if they can be engaged to do that.
I've been working with the road end committee for almost, it's coming up on 2 years now. I go to every meeting, and one of the things that this activity is intended to do is to help make their volunteer efforts more effective and organized. So right now, what had started out as all sorts of good intentions had become a bit of a scattershot, and we were creating situations where some road ends had neighbors or stewards that were very attentive and others didn't, and we opened ourselves up to the greater likelihood of encroachment because we weren't maintaining boundaries or paths or amenities, benches were broken, signs were gone missing, and we had no idea. The goal of this is not to stand in place of the volunteer efforts, it's to free the citizen committee and the volunteers that they help us to organize and access to leverage them in a more productive way so that then the steward program, which you mentioned, can be as effective as possible so that stewards understand I have this baseline of quarterly maintenance that will come through, and what I can do is either above that or beyond that, or maybe we can, to your point, organize and say this is a place where the neighbors really want the responsibility and you don't have to come and do the maintenance. But where we were starting from was so vague and unorganized that it really wasn't, I don't think, sustainable.
I applaud the need for organization and for making sure that it happens, but I think that the city has not done a good job of being proactive about encouraging volunteerism in city projects, and I think this is a wonderful opportunity to do that.
Mr. Bonkowski.
Along the same lines, you know, one of the things that the Park District does when they do this sort of thing is they do notification. So it would be, I think, beneficial to the community if, since this is a scheduled activity, to do the kind of notification of the local neighborhood of, a couple of persons are going to be there for a few hours on this particular road end at this time. And that then develops, I think, a little bit more of that community activity. Secondly, from a funding standpoint, is this funding coming out of the set-aside that we had for road ends, or is this separate funding?
No, this is being absorbed into the public works operations budget for the time being. That funding is designated for capital use only.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Blair.
Looking at the map, what is the road end that's wandering off loose over in the other part of Kitsap County, on the other side of that bridge? I'm curious about it. Was it just a wandering mark?
This is a citizen-developed Google map. As I said, we're working within the city's GIS system to develop our own data that people can
refer to. So that's wishful.
I'm not
sure.
Thank you. Okay, then to touch... Oh, I'm sorry.
Are you going to move forward to the trails?
And then to touch on a sort of similar but in some ways different exercise was to begin to acknowledge what our trail network means to us in terms of maintenance responsibilities. So the city has a portfolio of city-owned trails. They have not been something that we have actively organized or performed regular maintenance around. But as part of our increasing emphasis on non-motorized, as we continue to add to the trail network year after year, it seems to make good sense to understand the trails that are existing today, what their maintenance requirements are, and what we need to plan for to keep them in good working order so that they're safe and easy to use for the community. So as a first step, our public works staff, Sunny Ballou in particular, undertook a real boots-on-the-ground inventory of every single step of trail that is in the city-owned portfolio and has developed information on length, width, surface material, whether there are particular slope issues, whether there's special drainage needs, what kind of maintenance he thinks it would be need to take on a quarterly or annual basis, and use that as a starting point of understanding what we ought to do, similar to the road ends, to make sure that our trails are kept well-maintained and accessible. What he'd like to do next, and the next step that'll happen on our side, is, as you can imagine, there's all sorts of flavors of trails on our island. There are city-owned trails, which are our focus for now. But of course, he is also, as he navigates the world of trails, looking at and trying to identify where we have trails in private developments, which can be an important source of connectivity, even though they're not on city or public property. And then there are also park district trails and how these things connect. So we're going to take the inventory that he's done. He's going to work with our non-motorized committee, because they are a wealth of institutional knowledge about the network generally, and make sure that we have all matched up all the things we think are out there, and then work within our work plans to see what's needed to keep them up and running. And as it says in the memo, then as we go forward and continue to add to our network, we'll have this awareness that it doesn't just get built and then we turn to the next project. It gets built, it gets incorporated into our maintenance plans, and people are aware and give it regular attention. So, Kelly, I think there's one more slide. One of the things that's worth noting, this is a very rough work in progress, but just to give a little bit of a view, is that when we're talking about city-owned trails, these are almost exclusively in the Winslow area. There are only a few exceptions that we've identified at this point that are outside of Winslow. A couple things like there is a trail network of some sort at the Love Green Pit. I know the Park District put it in, but just in terms of capturing things on city property, there are trails at Pritchard. So outside of those two or three outliers, everything that we're talking about that's a city-owned trail is inside of Winslow. So that's where our focus is. So I just wanted to make you aware of this as well, in case you hear of it. They'll be working with non-motorized transportation committee, and hopefully there'll be more to report in terms of this is it. This is the universe of trails that belong to all different sorts of folks on the island.
Questions, Mr. Ward?
I didn't hear you mention precise location in the inventory. Is that something we already have, or something that still needs done?
That is what Sonny's developing, and he's building it with an eye towards it being a GIS data layer. So that is that your question? Is
yes.
Where that? So
yeah.
Right now it doesn't live within our GIS system. Part of what he's doing is collecting the data so that we can then map it, overlay it with other infrastructure.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Townsend.
And are these trails, have they been maintained historically, or is this a newer program?
My impression, and I know Barry hasn't been here very long, so I don't know that if he has anything to add, he'll jump in. But my impression is they've been maintained on sort of an as-needed basis. Someone calls in and says the trail's completely washed out or the trail's completely overgrown. But it hasn't been part of our regular operations. It hasn't been on our radar in that way.
Okay. Mr. Tollison.
Just fulfill my need to have an opinion about everything. I just hope that as we get more into this idea of maintaining our trails, that we don't lose sight of the potential opportunity of working with the Park District, which has a lot of expertise on building and maintaining trails, and even possibly going so far as to think about developing some sort of an ILA with the Park District, whereby they might take on some of that for us.
I think just to reassure you, that was at the front of our thinking when we launched this. And so part of what has been important about Sonny giving so much detail to his surveying is, until we understand what we own and how much of it there is and what type of it, we won't know what benefit there might be from a cooperative arrangement. But yeah, that's definitely part of the thinking as we go along.
Other comments from the council? Are there public comments about this issue? Yes, please.
I'm Dana Berg, chair of Go Bainbridge, which promotes sustainable transportation, and we've been working with the Road Ends Committee and the city, and it's been very great. We put on the first ever Road Ends event the 1st of June, and we had over 100 people walk the Road Ends of Winslow, and every one of them was so excited about our Road Ends. So I just want to thank the city for helping. They did some maintenance right before that, and it really helped the event. But I really want to talk about just non-motorized in general on our paths on Bainbridge Island. As most people know, the history of Bainbridge Island started with people going around by boat, and they got to the boats on paths. There were no cars or roads on Bainbridge. Everybody walked everywhere. My mother-in-law, who's 87, told me she used to walk to high school every day from Ferncliff, and she would meet all the kids from Wing Point, and they would go up High School Road and walk to school, even though by then, of course, there were cars. But somehow, all of those pathways have turned into roadways. They're for cars, and most of them, that are the major ones, Miller, Sunrise, wherever, you can't even walk on them. The speed of traffic, the amount of traffic, and no shoulders, no sidewalks, no paths or anything. And I believe that we should have the goal that everyone on Bainbridge Island can comfortably walk or bike anywhere they want to go. We shouldn't be forced to get into our cars if we want to go somewhere. And because of that, pathways are critical. And the fact that the city is now really recognizing it and putting on their radar is extremely important. And we need to have them all connected. One thing that I would like you to think of as a pathway is the side of the road. Because our roadways are really public pathways. And a lot of them have sidewalks around Winslow, which is great. And some of them have paths, but most of them don't. And one thing I've noticed, I've been out checking a lot of them, is that if they were just mowed all the time, people could walk there. Parts of Sunrise you could walk on. Other parts of Sunrise, people have laurel hedges that grow into the fog line. So you have to jump out into the road to get around that. And maybe you could work with property owners to get that back. I don't know. But that is absolutely, pathways and trails all over the island are the sides of our roads. So I hope you consider that when you're thinking about paths. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
So I'm Charles Schmidt. I'm speaking as chair of the Waterfront Trail Committee, which is actually under the Parks Trails Committee. But we've really appreciated the help of the city on the trail, which actually goes all the way from the ferry to Holly Cove and also goes from the ferry all the way to Gowan Place. So it goes extensively throughout Winslow. It's very important both for the residents to use and for visitors to come. This pamphlet I handed out earlier, we're through the Chamber of Commerce, we've distributed about 12,000 of those to visitors, but also to residents finding out our historic sites and also our significant trees, not just to come here and just sort of wander around town and say, where's the water, but sort of see where historic sites are and also where significant trees are. Val mentioned a little bit about getting volunteers together. Some projects we can actually, we put in a bench, I say ABC, Bart Berg, and the city helped out to put in a bench at the end of Level. And so that was good. But other ones that we've worked on are major ones that it's really nice to have the city assist in cleaning up. One is right along where the trail starts down Harborview and goes in front of the Washington State Ferries. Those blackberries that keep coming down really start coming down, and the city is just great because I'll go there saying, you know, with my little clippers and a few other people to just see the city with their big hedge cutters and some sort of device, because I don't see them do it, just take all those down in a short time. Also, where the waterfront trail goes along Seabreeze, there is we planted 2003 some native vegetation and nice little plants, but now they're pretty overgrown plants. And it's really nice to see the city do that. And the city's public works department's really helped us a lot to put in signage. So I just thought I'd say how much I appreciated that. Thanks.
Thank you, Charles. Other comments on this topic? Yes, sir.
I'm Don Fisher. Live on Wood Avenue and have been a member of the Road Ends Committee for over two decades. And I just want to thank the city for what they have suddenly picked up and done for us and the Road Ends Committee. And I just want to express it from the Road Ends Committee that it was been great, and I hope this will continue.
Thank you. Ms. Blair.
Thank you. The other thing that I don't know that we necessarily had an opportunity to call out, and that was the work of the Bainbridge Island woodworkers that are working with Road Ends and building the benches and have offered to do that as one of their community outreach projects. And so that's something that's being done collaboratively with the city and the Road Ends Committee. And by doing that kind of work, there's also some standardizing as well as dealing with any of the potential risk of projects that, in fact, they are built to a public use standard.
and so the safety measures are being met. But I think that's another way that a community group has been involved and actively sought out. So they also deserve our thank yous and recognition.
That's it.
Mr. Townsend.
Yeah, just, I was wondering if you could speak to the issue of what the city's position is on the trails being suitable for bike usage, or because I've walked a lot of these trails and they really aren't something you'd want to ride a bike on, or maybe, mm-hmm. but at what level are we maintaining, and is that...
Well, I think that's a good question to take into that conversation, starting at the non-motorized transportation committee. So start with, these are the trails we've identified. What do we want to maintain to? So certainly the trails as they are today are a variety of materials, a variety of widths, probably a variety of tolerance for the up and down. And the question, I think that's a great dimension to add, is what do we want to aim for?
Other comments or questions on this topic from the council? All right. Let's hear from Mr. Lovelace on item 4C, grant opportunity for Wyatt Way reconstruction.
Good evening. So this item is the requesting authorization to allow Public Works to approve for apply for a Transportation Improvement Board grant for the Wyatt Way reconstruction. So background on this project, it's been a project that's been in our CIP for many years. In fact, I think in 2006, it got to about 50% design. There's always been a question of availability of funds and how it would be funded. So there's been some recent activity and information about the Transportation Improvement Board that we've tapped into and has caused us to make a recommendation that we pursue a grant for this project. So there was a grant opportunity that's being offered this year, which is obviously a key. There was a training session last month that we sent Chris Hammer to find out kind of how the programs work, how the criteria has changed, whether or not our project could potentially score well, whether it'd be competitive with the rest of the region that we're competing with, and some of the particulars of the scoring algorithm and whether or not we could perhaps achieve a competitive score. So he brought that information back, was not particularly encouraged. He thought that the criteria had actually tightened up from the last time we applied and we might not be as competitive as before. But we continue to look at it, and a key to the project really is the tie-in with new development, primarily the GROW development. So this program is intended to build urban arterials, particularly under this part of the program, that accommodates new growth. So if you have a component of new growth development, that helps you score much better. We were worried about the timing of that new growth, and that this is really, this advertises a 2016 program, really, even though the money could be available earlier, and that the GROW development is proceeding on, and they would probably need to improve their, they've already improved part of the right-of-way on Wyatt, and then they have the section where the old Navy housing is that they're going to, in short order, tear down and redevelop that. And so that particular right-of-way improvement could count as part of the match and help us be competitive. So last week, a representative from the TIB board actually came, visited the city. We walked him around, showed him the project, talked about the components of it, and it looks like things will actually work out well as long as the development happens within a year of application. Application date is August, so even if they develop it in the next year before we even potentially get grant funds, we can still use that as the kind of the development hook that helps us with the growth component of the score. So it looks like that will work for us. So this project, like I said, has been in our CIP for a while. It's actually in the outer years, and we're not proposing that it would be funded for construction in the next biennial budget, the 2-year 15-16. 15-16 would be where we'd be looking at right-of-way acquisition and that kind of thing. And then we have up to 10 years to spend the money. So if the grant match that we'd have to come up with would be somewhere outside the 2-year 15-16 budget, probably no earlier than 17, 18, or 19, so depending on how the right-of-way went. So I think it still matches or pretty well is in concert with our CIP that we've talked about before. the right-of-way acquisition, as you recall, under the Transportation Benefit District, we authorized, or the council authorized, spending a certain amount of that money beginning in 2014 on right-of-way acquisition for future project preparation. So we could use this project. This project is what we were envisioning starting that on anyway. But the good thing about the TIB program as opposed to the KRCC PSRC type program is this pays for all phases at once. So design, right-of-way, construction, all at once, that all gets rolled in. You don't have to do the, you know, design and right-of-way in one phase or design and construction in another phase. So it doesn't have to spread out over multiple funding cycles. If you're competitive, you can be you can get the whole the whole pot of money, and then you have a long time, relatively long time to spend it, up to 10 years. So it seems to be a good fit for our capital planning. Obviously, it's not a guarantee. We just be authorizing tonight, if you agree, to actually submit the application. So the total cost of the project, right-of-way, design, construction, is estimated at $3.7 million. And the minimum local match is 20%. After talking with the TIB staff, in order to be as competitive as possible, we could go up to 32% match, which that's a big chunk of money, $1.2 million approximately. But it could be spent. It would be spent over a couple years at least, and it would be an out-year budget. And we could adjust our other capital plans potentially to make room for that, if we're successful, obviously. So that's the proposal, and just the scope briefly is improvements to the intersection with Wyatt and Madison. So in the past, we've looked at a potential roundabout or a minimum left turn lanes in all four directions, and continuing with the four-way stop and positioning for a future light traffic controlled traffic signal at that location. So we'd still be looking at those options as we go forward into planning and design. And then completion of bike lanes and sidewalks on both sides from Madison to Lovell. So there's some missing sections in there. Obviously, the Grow development has done their piece in front of their current frontage, but we have other pieces of missing segments in there. So it'd complete that full complete street improvement through that section. Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Townsend?
I just wondered that. So you said bike lanes from Madison to Lovell, and then the scope would be Wyatt and Madison. Can you tell me, I feel like I'm looking for a visual or a better sense of what we're looking at or what the intended ultimate scope is.
I have the project sheet that was in the CIP, but it doesn't have a great visual. But basically, it's Wyatt from Madison heading toward South End, it would be two lanes of traffic as we currently have, a bike lane on either side at the edge of the travel lane, and then a separate
down the hill there past Grow that way. Or?
Right. Yeah. Yes. Toward past Grow, and Lovell is just the next street past Grow, so it's not a long distance. And then it picks up. There's a trail already out there and a sidewalk as it heads down toward Weaver, and then sidewalk ends, but the shoulder improvements continue. There's still some segments that need improvement, obviously, that way too. But and then there'd be turn lanes as a minimum or a traffic circle at Wyatt and Madison intersection, and then sidewalks in addition to the bike lanes. That's the plan.
And this is, tell me more about it being consistent with the CIP and what we've looked at in terms of the CIP and mm-hmm. Did you say that before?
Well, it's not in the, the big chunk of money, the $1 million construction primarily match funds that the city would have to come up with. We wouldn't be looking for those funds in the 2015-16 budget. They'd be in the out-years budget, which they currently are in our CIP. They're probably, if we're successful, we're probably going to need to move them closer to the current year once we look at the next budget cycle. But they're really not talking about construction or big dollars out of this 15-16 budget cycle that we've already gone through several times. All we're really talking about there is some money to pursue the right-of-way, to do the right-of-way study, the appraisals, and potentially acquire some right-of-way in the next couple years. And we have some money set aside under the Transportation Benefit District to do that.
Ms. Blair.
I'm very, very supportive, and I'm thrilled at the possibility of having bike lanes on both sides of Wyatt, I think that's essential, and the fact that we have the complete streets ordinance and that we're going in that direction, I would be very supportive of doing this. So I'm thrilled with the possibility, and I really encourage us to think about the 32% local match, in that we have the funds set in that direction, and we need to do everything we can to get this funding and make it happen. I like this plan as opposed to doing it piecemeal. So that also is an additional bonus or additional positive piece. Thanks.
Other comments from the council? Ms. Blossom?
So is this a grant to improve a street that's been impacted by new development?
Well, that's the primary, I guess, theory behind the program. As new development and new traffic comes onto a street, it's intended, the scoring is set up to try to help cities accommodate growth in that way.
So when you talk about the intersection of Wyatt and Madison and needing turn lanes and potentially a stoplight, maybe a roundabout, does that mean that that intersection is going to fail because of the GROW community?
Well, the current level of service is D, I think, is what we've said in our plan. I'm not sure. I haven't looked specifically at the GROW community traffic study to see if that's true or not. I don't think it is, but I'd have to check that. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that. Basically, you have to describe how you've had growth, and it's not asking that it has to be. It's not requiring a failing level of service. It's just looking for impacts from growth.
So I guess my comment doesn't really have to do with this grant. It's more what I've heard in this conversation. Because I know that when the GROW community was proposed, there were a lot of questions about the impacts of the traffic, and that we were assured that it was not going to have an impact, and the intersection was fine. And I feel like I'm hearing otherwise. And so I'm glad we're doing our traffic study.
It was the other intersection.
No. Well, I know in conversations that I've had that the intersection of Wyatt and Madison came up a lot, and whether the GROW community was going to push it towards a failing level, and we were told over and over again it would not, and that's why they didn't have to make improvements to it.
Other comments? Mr. Bonkowski.
I move the City Council authorize Public Works staff to move forward with the TIB Urban Air Arterial Program Grant application for the Wyatt Way Reconstruction Project and commit to fund the project in the 2015-16 budget cycle over a four-year period in an estimated amount of $3.7 million with a 32% match if the grant is successful.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Yes, I'm aware. Public comment before we vote.
Thank you. My name is Debbie Lester. I live at 266 Erickson Avenue Northeast, and I was quite surprised to see the roundabout come back again, and I would hope that we will have thorough public conversation about that particular intersection and a potential of a roundabout. Ideally, I would love to see the focus of bike and pedestrian facilities the entire length of Wyatt rather than cutting it off at level. Anyone that bikes that knows that currently the north side of the Wyatt is fairly dangerous to ride your bike or to walk. So that would be what I would hope that you would consider creating the parameters of that particular grant application. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Yes, sir.
My name is Eric Fredericks. I live at 7776 Yomo Point Drive. I came to this council meeting to listen about LTAC, but as a property owner who owns the corner of Wyatt and Madison, I'm just kind of appalled that there's been no discussion with any of the property owners to return to the issues that we reviewed the last time the roundabout was proposed, when it was found it's going to be much smaller radius than the one at High School Road, that it will come within 12 inches of the corner of the Wyatt condos. That's the corner of the building. That's how close the cars come. And, of course, Chris Odorowski, my neighbor across the street, was adamant that he was going to sue the city if they tried to do that to his. Our previous tenant, Madison, which is now up in Rolling Bay, left the premises and left his lease because he said he wouldn't be able to operate his business there with the roundabout. So is this the cart pulling the horse, the grant pushing the project? No community input. You already had it 5 years ago. It was very much opposed by the people on the corner. The girl community had the traffic study. I've gone to the city with some proposals for apartments on the corner that would require a traffic study. Is this to benefit the development, or is this to just exactly what's happening? And how can you apply for a grant before you find out if it's even viable with the property owners who are going to be have to have the property acquired through eminent domain in order to make a circle work? Thank you.
Other comments from the public? I have a comment from Ms. Blair. Excuse me.
I guess I think those are important questions, and I was just going to ask if Mr. Lovelace could help us understand it better. I didn't hear a decision about a roundabout or revisiting it, and I also think that the comments that Ms. Lester made about extending it on down level make some, I mean, they don't make some sense, they make a lot of sense. But I guess I would be interested in your thoughts about the comments that both people have made on this.
Well, I did mention that we'd be looking at the option of that roundabout again. I guess we could rule that out the at this point, whether this council wanted to look at that option again or not. Something improvement needs to be done to the intersection, and so that's one of the options as we go forward and look at design and whether or not enough right of way is available there or not. As far as extending the project, I guess in general, it's an expensive project already. It's going to take a pretty good chunk of this program, and it's well recognized. There's plenty of other areas that are probably close by that could be added on, but you have to cut it off somewhere in order to have a project that's. Mm-hmm. Size that it gives you a complete project, but it also it doesn't take up the whole pot of money for the state, kind of thing. So,
okay, but it will absolutely include further conversation. I mean, what you're doing is applying for money that will deal with the design questions,
right, and the right-of-way questions.
Okay,
yes.
And so that I mean, I guess I'm saying that to Eric as an indication that this is, if this were to be successful, the things you're concerned about are absolutely already on the table and will be and need to be called to task when the time mm-hmm. comes.
Right.
Thank you.
Mr. Townsend and Mr. Ward.
Well, I wanted to support Ms. Blossom's comment about making sure that we're, while we're solving a problem that exists, that, you know, we need to have development not create the problem in the first place going forward. And then the other on the bike issue is what strikes me that would make sense is having a logical way for people to bike from the south end of the island to the ferry, because that's such a thoroughfare. So to the extent that we're tracking commuting bikers up Wyatt, if you go down to Erickson, that's a, you know, that's an awkward intersection that would have to be solved if you're tracking a lot of bikers through there. So the only thought that makes sense, and this I guess this goes back to the non-motorized transportation group, is to have a logical way for bikers to efficiently get from the south end of the island to the ferry mm-hmm. In a way that isn't a patchwork that doesn't make sense. Ultimately, there's the master
plan. Right, and the, you know, this is part. It is part of a longer-term vision of east-west connectivity. We have the north-south connectivity. We're working on the Sound Olympics Trail. And we're improving Wing Point Way from the east, mm-hmm. Wyatt from the west, hoping to get a solution at the SR 305 crossing and right. so that the east-west connections could potentially get to that Sound Olympics Trail and have more of a, you know, a high-speed connection and not meander through the downtown. That's right. the long-term vision. It's a lot of pieces involved there. But
so I guess that the thought process to go from Wyatt to the ferry, are you gonna send people straight up east and then north, or then south? And go north and then go around to Vineyard Lane.
Well, the connection to 305 is still right. to be designed, to be looked at. That's another issue of where do we have right of way available? What's the best point that we can try to get an east-west connection from roughly Wing Point to Wyatt across 305, and then the direct connection down 305, of course, to the ferry. We're working on that, and that's going to be pretty certain at this point.
Okay. Yeah, just. Tell me you're thinking about all those things that go together. And
right, it all comes together, but it's a piece at a time, obviously.
Okay. Of course.
Mr. Martin.
I just want to remind everybody that, if you recall, several months ago, many of us participated in upgrading the standards of the traffic studies because the Cave Avenue one and this one were seemingly too casual. And I think we have solved that, but we've still got the lingering problems from some of the ones that were approved before that.
Thank you. Any other comments from the council before we vote? Are we ready to vote?
I think there's one other comment.
One more.
One of the other things that Val Tolis and I have talked about is putting an item on the agenda to look at the potential of building out all the non-motorized in the core 440. When you look at the ability to bond for that, the Transportation Benefit District, the revenue coming out of that is probably adequate to put together a substantial enough bond. And so one of the things that we wanted to put on the agenda for council discussion is to look at that, which is kind of a let's get this done and not do it piecemeal. So I think that's something that we are going to be talking about when we do the agenda setting this afternoon.
Further comments on the motion? If not, all those in favor, signify, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Thank you. Thank you, Barry. Back to Deputy Manager Smith. Commercial lease agreement for the municipal courthouse, item 4D.
Good evening again, Council. This item is a lease agreement for the facility the city is currently using for its municipal court up in Rolling Bay. It's not an actual renewal, it's a new lease agreement. I want to make sure we're clear on that. The city's existing lease will expire on August 1st. It was a three-year agreement that we entered into in 2011. We, as described in the memo in your packet, we had the opportunity to request a renewal term, but the mechanism for that renewal would have required written notice 6 months ahead of the lease expiration. That would have been back in January. And unfortunately, we weren't monitoring that, and so we missed that window and were informed by the landlord that they intended to negotiate a new lease. I can highlight for you some of the important changes. You'll see in the redline version, I notice an awful lot of formatting. I know that makes it hard for you to identify where the changes are, so if you have any questions, please let me know. But a lot of it had to do with the fact that the documentation we had on the original lease was pretty messy, so we had to kind of write it over again. So that made the redline muddy. But the term of the new lease that we are asking you to consider tonight would be a three-year term that starts August 1st of this year and runs to July 31st of 2017. It also, you'll see, provides the opportunity for two renewal periods of up to 2 years each. We thought it was important to preserve that much potential length as we go into conversations about what might or might not change about our municipal court. We want to be able to have the fallback to stay in that facility if that's a decision that we need either for the medium or longer term. As you'll recall, hopefully, in 2011, as part of the lease renewal at that point, the community stepped forward and made some pretty significant investments in that building at no cost to the city. And so that was intended to make sure the facility had met security and operational requirements that we needed to keep the court meeting some of the particular safety features of its operations. So that's the term. The rent, as you'll see, is a significant increase from what we're paying today, is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is it returns us to the level that we were paying for approximately 10 years before that. Certainly it would be preferable if we had been able to renew and preserve that reduced rent, but that was not something we were able to come to agreement with the landlord. In the memo, you'll see that I, as part of our work on what we would like to propose for this lease, we did take the time to look at some other options here in town to understand comparable expenses, and you'll see some of those listed. The Rolling Bay facility is still considerably cheaper. However, it is not an in-town location, and any new facility we went to, we'd need to plan for that investment in some of those purpose-built safety features like security cameras, bulletproof glass, and separation rooms. So we estimate that if we come to that decision, whether it's sooner or later down the road, we need to plan, if it's a building that we are retrofitting, to plan for something around the neighborhood of $100,000 for those costs. Another change that was added is our previous lease did not have a clause to permit early termination. We felt like in the context of the conversations we're having now about facility planning, that was a really important add from the city's perspective. So you'll see that we've included that as a new provision. We can request termination of the lease without penalty with 6 months' notice, which, again, given the nature of the facility we're talking about, we would need a pretty decent lead time to get any place we were going to set up properly. So it won't be a decision we'd be making on, you know, just a couple weeks' notice anyway. So that works well for us in the future, I think. Gives us a lot of flexibility. The cost of living increase used to be pegged to a certain CPI. Given the amount of money involved for both ends, it was simpler administratively to move to a fixed 2% increase annually. And then almost all of the other changes are to remove specific language that was captured in the 2011 lease to enforce the facility improvements that were being requested to meet those safety features. And so there's no longer a need to keep all of that language because those improvements have occurred and are all concluded. So those are the highlights of the lease. I'd be happy to talk with you about any questions.
Questions? Comments from the council? Mr. Tollefson?
Has there been some system change to give us some assurance that similar deadlines will be picked up in the future?
I would hope that we have learned from this experience the places where we have some blind spots in our current contract and lease management, and we'll want to not only tighten up how the people involved control for that, but I think we were talking with Councilmember Roth about perhaps putting some things in when we set up lease agreements into our financial system that can help us be an extra flag well in advance. I will say it's fairly unusual. I think there were a couple of different ingredients that led to this oversight, and I won't go into all of those, but one of them is it was fairly unusual for us to have that kind of proactive, we need to reach out that early. So I think that was a factor, but we can solve for that.
So I take it the answer to my question is yes.
The answer is a long, overly wordy yes.
Other comments, questions? Matt Roger.
I move that the City Council forward the commercial lease agreement substantially in the form attached to the July 28, 2014 consent agenda.
Is there a second? There is a second. Before we have further discussion, I'll take public comment.
Quickly, council members, my name is Andy Mayer, and I spoke earlier before about the decision you have to make on upcoming months about co-locating the court with the police, and I guess see the obvious that if you conclude that you will not do that, I urge you to go right then into where will you locate the court, because the plan up till now had been to eventually put the court in Winslow, and that will take some time to locate and pay for. So I would hope that if that decision goes that way, that we not wait till the end of the 3 years and after the extension, that you move right into that. So Just a somewhat obvious suggestion, but we can't forget about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Any further discussion on the motion to forward this to the consent agenda for July 28? All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. The LTAC award cycle, back with our deputy city mayor.
It's like I never left.
Ms. Smith.
So this on your agenda tonight is primarily a council discussion. I want to give you a little context and get it kicked off, but then I hope that your LTAC chair, Councilmember Blossom, and co-chair, Councilmember Townsend, will lead you through the conversation that you have amongst yourselves. To give you a feel for what the intent is tonight or what some of the goals are, the city issues an RFP once a year to solicit proposals for projects that will receive LTAC funding. And the RFP itself captures the criteria by which the projects will be judged, and so it shapes the proposals that people make. And so what we are intending to do tonight is get council feedback on some of the things that are up for policy choices. There are things about LTAC that are extremely technical and are rigorously enforced in terms of eligibility and state meeting the state statutes, and those aren't part of the discussion tonight. But there's also latitude in some dimensions of the kind of projects you're seeking to encourage by your scoring criteria, the amount of money that you will be giving out in the award pool, those kinds of things. So we want to lead you through, if you look in the council packet, there's essentially six areas of discussion that we're hoping to get your feedback on, and then we'll take those away and use them to finalize a version of the RFP. We'll bring that back to you so you will see it one more time before it is actually launched. I'm going to start you out with number one, which is the total estimated award funding. And I believe this is in your package, because so that people can see here tonight, this is something we usually show you about this time of the year. The balance in the fund was about $134,000 on January 1st. We've issued contracts for $127,000 in awards for this year. If all of the recipients spend all of their award money, which I hope they do, we will have about $126,000 left in the fund balance. We advise against awarding out fully because, of course, you can see that revenue number is an estimate, and we get that revenue monthly. So it's advisable, while in the last 3 or 4 years we have been aiming to minimize the amount of funds that are left in the account, as opposed to prior to that when we were building up a pretty significant cushion. So you want to aim for something close to the estimated year-end balance. I would suggest for planning purposes at this point that you plan for $120,000 in awards. So I don't know if there's discussion or questions about that component.
How do you want to proceed? Would you like to have our co-chair, you want to take us through all six and then turn it over to the committee chairs?
I think some of these are more weighty than others, so if there are things that you don't have feedback on or that you find acceptable, to just indicate that, we'll move on to the next.
She's warming us up with the softball.
Okay, so nobody refuting the $120,000 recommendation?
So there's a memo in your packet that outlines the six things we want to talk through tonight, and let me know if you need a copy of that. So unless you have questions, we'll assume we're working with an award pool of about $120,000 for next year. The next thing is where I will step away and listen to what council would like to say, but we'd like you to take a look at the criteria that we'll be using to score the projects. What we've included in the memo in your packet is the criteria from last year and the weighting from last year. And so as an initial proposal, I believe the council chair and co-chair are suggesting we start with those criteria, but are very much interested in hearing from the rest of council.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll tell you some of the comments that we've heard about these. And it's interesting, we had this discussion earlier about the police department. I mean, the weighting here is really the key policy decision. So each of you should reflect on that. I think there was some expression and comment today about
whether or not having a number E, having an organization that has historical success, whether that's an appropriate criteria because it discourages new groups from forming. And then similarly, this issue of partnerships, which actually dovetails with the maximum award and the partial funding issue both. So maybe those are taken as a whole. One of the comments was, of the $125,000, is it appropriate to cap each individual grant at $15,000? And then if that's the case, does it make sense to allow groups to pool for a single grant, larger funding? And then similarly, number six, these are, I think, really the meaty policy decisions, whether or not it makes sense to permit LTAC to grant partial funding, which is distinct from a RFP that might say, well, we would like to get funded at this level, and then having a tiered proposal, whereas if someone said, well, we would like $15,000, and then whether the committee would have the authority to just say, well, here's $10,000, and do what you can with it. And I think the feedback was pretty consistent that that's not a constructive way to do grants. And I think Sarah and I would both agree that that's along with Morgan, that that's not a good idea to allow partial funding. But this issue of the maximum fund is a real policy decision. Do you want to allow multiple smaller grants, or is it better to have one larger, higher impact grant? And whether or not that's a decision that gets made in advance or on a case-by-case basis. I would welcome people's inputs on that. I certainly have an opinion, but I don't want to taint it. And I think also, it all goes back to the scoring, and maybe this isn't a decision that can be made kind of on the fly if people haven't had a chance to digest these numbers. But those really are where we kind of do our weighting in terms of what the criteria will be.
I understand, if I could just ask this question of the presenter. I understand E and F, but is there some history of the program that might bear on your notion that E and F might be open to change? But is there other aspects of the history of the program that should influence the decision, not the weighting, but the first four criteria?
Did you want to get her
an answer?
I was looking for an answer from the committee, whether the committee itself had come to any conclusions. All right, then.
A lot of the history is...
All right. With respect to F, one of the... And this kind of couples into the 15,000. One of the things that we found is you would receive a number of proposals from different organizations that... In some respects, did an awful lot of overlap in doing the same thing. So what we were trying to encourage was the organizations to get together and say that I'll do this and you do that, and we can share data. And that's what the whole emphasis on F was. The emphasis on E was. Basically, do they have any history at all from an accounting standpoint, a success standpoint?
Right.
So that was the basis for E and F, and why those criteria were included. Why the weighting? I mean, you can play any game you want. The only big change we made last year was the much heavier weighting on overnight stays in the off season. Because in the on season, for the most part, all the hotel rooms are rented, and so it's in the shoulder seasons and certainly in the off season. And so, projects that had emphasis in that area, we felt should have a higher weighting.
Shall we have more discussion on the criteria. Roger talked about several, but let's talk about the criteria before we move to maximum award, if we could. Sarah?
Well, I just want to point out, too, that if there's criteria you want to add, it's not limited to this. So if...
Would it be handy to hear from the community before we move further?
If you wish, happy to... There's at least one person who came tonight to speak to this, and there may be several.
Or four.
Would you like to speak now about this, please? We're all interested in all the information we can acquire. So this would be criteria F here. So come on up.
No,
I'm just saying. This is the collaborative. This is the collaborative thing. Yes.
Oh, yeah. For those who have not met her yet, Jerry Lane is the new executive director of the Downtown Association. So she's the third leg of this stool. Which last year, looking at part F, as you know, when we submitted our projects, they were non-duplicating, they were supporting of each other, and we were working on different aspects of tourism marketing and promotion. So what you have here is the three organizations that do the bulk of the work on the island. We are the ones that meet and greet. We are the ones that supply the people that supply the money, which is what Eric's organization does. And once we get them on the island, come downtown, then Jerry's organization will take care of the people that come out on the main street. So that's the partnership segment of it. And what we want to suggest is that the three of us have an expertise that goes back many, many years. The Chamber's been here for 85 years, Downtown Association for many years, Lodging Association for many years. So we have an expertise in doing what is required of LTAC, which is the marketing of tourism on the island. Bottom line. Eric, do you want to say anything?
Well, we also have learned over the last many years what doesn't work. What doesn't work is many small efforts made to bring overnight lodgers to Bainbridge Island. What does work is a coordinated effort in a very competitive internet market, social marketing, where blogging is important, your web page is important, the time people spend on your web page is important, how many visits, how many inquiries, all this is important. And so Downtown Association had a great expertise with media, print media in particular. Chamber has the expertise with meeting and greeting people as they walk off the ferry and directing pedestrian traffic. Our focus as the Bainbridge Island Lodging Association, realizing we couldn't just do an ad in Sunset Magazine and do something else the next year, it was all about the internet, because 95% of our bookings come through the internet. They don't come through local flyers or anything else. They come through the internet. And 90% of that traffic is driven by building Bainbridge Island as now the seventh most popular place and best place, according to USA Magazine, to spend a weekend. And the idea is to boost the economy by using these dollars that are taxed only to the lodgers to create more lodgers, which in turn spend more dollars. And our only regret is that we didn't figure this out earlier, because if we did, you'd be looking at $200,000 to $250,000 of LTAC money instead of $120,000 to $125,000. We can fill the off-season. We're a small island. We can fill it if we market to people that will spend nights on Bainbridge Island off-season and then go to Four Swallows and the art gallery and the museum and the historical society. But we can only do that with a coordinated campaign. So as soon as you say $15,000 limit, you say, well, we're going to go back to the old days where we just hand out presents to all of our favorite organizations and they all just do whatever they want. And it sounds good and everybody's happy. But this whole legislative intent, which Christine Rolfs and Sherry Appleton and Drew Hansen have all agreed in the last legislative session, was to bring overnight lodgers to the island. That's what we're supposed to be spending the money for. And then they, in turn, spend seven times what they spend at overnight lodging, or I'm sorry, they spend seven times what a day visitor spends. They spend 3.5 times what they spend on overnight lodging on Bainbridge businesses, which adds more sales tax dollars to our tax base. and builds our economy.
Hello, Council. This is my first time to be before you. I am 30 days on the job, but I do come with a pedigree of hospitality marketing. I spent 5 years as Senior Vice President of Marketing with Visit Seattle, and before that was Director of Sales and Marketing for both the Westin Seattle and the Sheraton Seattle. So I know a bit about hospitality marketing. I don't want to be coloring outside the lines here, but coming from Seattle, there's always a temptation to dip into the lodging tax fund. It's always a very juicy little plum and everybody wants a piece. But in order to have a strong and effective campaign with $100,000, $120,000, you need to consolidate those funds as much as possible. Those enable us not necessarily to go out and buy billboards in San Francisco, but it does enable us to have some very effective partnerships with key cities that are doing the work for us. It allows us to piggyback on what Visit Seattle is doing. They're spending $7 million a year to bring in marketing strictly to leisure travelers who generally are going to consider a trip to Bainbridge. And it's up to us to get that message out. The last thing I'll say is it's our job to market all of the attractions, restaurants, hotels, shopping, all of the things that make Bainbridge Island so unique. So when you take bits and pieces away, it inhibits our ability to reach out to that broader audience and to tell that big story. And that's our job. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Blair.
So it sounds to me as though those comments are asking for two things. One, to change or at least consider in raising the maximum award, and in terms of the criteria, to give greater weight to a partnership effort. I mean, is that how you've heard what, I mean, is that how their message translates? And if that's one that we would support, which in some ways, I mean, a couple of things, I have a personal reaction to it, but I would like to know, is that how you, as those who will be chairing this effort, is that what you heard, or do you hear something else?
I heard the maximum award was a proposal to be added. It's not currently part of the...
Well, it says right? 15,000 here was an idea that was just recommended. And they're saying change that and, in fact, raise it. And we can discuss what that level is, but that is what you're hearing. And what is your thinking as those who will be chairing this and have undoubtedly talked to many people who have submitted proposals in the past?
I'm sympathetic to not hamstringing the committee on a maximum amount and have something that makes sense to use the funds in a way that are consistent with the goals of the LTAC and not have the $15,000 maximum, and then therefore not necessarily, in my personal opinion, that the importance of partnership. I think to Steve's point, it makes a lot of sense to have a coordinated effort. And one thing that I would propose adding is a criteria or a measurement of measurability as to whether or not the program is successful, and that would be something. That would
you mean
be
an evaluation?
An evaluation
component.
Criteria.
Okay,
so
evaluation.
Category
assessment.
G.
Okay.
But it would be my personal recommendation. But I do hear that there was an opposition to the maximum award.
Sarah?
That's what I heard, yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
And I didn't hear them speak to the other issues necessarily, mostly to the maximum award and making sure that what we have is consistent with LTAC and is not just kind of rated for other purposes. And to that end, I think that's a vote in favor of some having something that I think some of the feedback has been, this seemed like a good idea, but it's not clear whether or not it is effective or is part of a coordinated campaign, and I think that was echoed
here in the comments tonight.
Mr. Ward.
Two comments. I'm reading through the criteria A, and I'm just wondering why 50 miles, and then I say, well, maybe it's to get people to spend the night. If indeed that's the case, it would seem that A and B and A and D are very closely linked, and does it make sense to combine those criteria in some manner? And then secondly, on the maximum award amount, I would agree with the previous speakers that, you know, if you're going with the theory that if you divide it up into a bunch of small grants, then we should really give out 10,000 grants for $12, and we'll really maximize our money, and that obviously is taking it to a ridiculous extreme. So I'd really love to see us keep the door open for a joint proposal that maybe was the entire amount of money, as long as it came with appropriate metrics that would allow the results to be measured.
I have a question about for Morgan. No, none of these funds may be used for grant administration, or may they be used for grants administration?
They may not be used for general operations according to the guidelines that we include in our RFP. Up until recently, they could be used for capital projects.
I'm talking about the cost of administering the grant program.
Internally?
Yes.
You mean for the city?
For the city. We have not done that, and I would suggest we don't want to start.
Okay. Well, I just thought if we gave out $10,000, $12 grants, we might want to consider it. This is the how long is the string thing. If we give out one grant of $125,000, the administration
would,
is.
I will go one step further now that I'm hearing your actual question. That would not be an eligible use of the LTAC.
Okay. And that was my understanding. Want to make sure that it's clear. All right. Thank you. Mr. Bonkowski.
The other thing is I'm not supportive of the city using any of the project funds for the following
reasons. This would be item number four?
Item number four, which we haven't talked about.
This is a good time to bring it up.
The city has a lot of opportunity to spend money in advertising, in promotions, and it can do it out of any general fund. This is the only funds that these organizations typically can get from the city. And so from my perspective, having the city compete with the lodging organizations and the hospitality organizations just isn't appropriate. And so I would not support having a set aside for city projects or a city proposal to spend this very, very limited amount of money. If there's something that is really important to do, for example, you know, right now we are we have a new bus that is being, you know, moved around the island from 9 to 4 in the afternoon, and the agreement that we had with the transit district is that they'd provide the bus and we would provide the advertising, you know. And so, yes, I'm sure we could use the LTAC funds to do the advertising because it would be a legitimate thing, and you could make a judgment that would be appropriate to for tourism. But I don't think that's where the money should come from. And, you know, we ought to have a set aside in our general fund for that advertising, which, by the way, I haven't seen. So just as an aside.
If I might circle back around to my opening suggestion that we take these each separately to see where we are, rather than jumping from the maximum now to number four, 3 to 4, let's see where we have some guidance for the staff on these 1 through 6. Well, 1 is all right, we're okay. Going path of least resistance, could we go to 5 and 6? Are there people who wish to speak for or against the matching funds or the partial funding, elimination of partial funding? Sarah?
Are we done with the criteria?
No, what I'm trying to do is focus on the one or two issues that are most need discussion. So it's safe. Oh, sorry. Speak quickly lose you.
No, go ahead.
I was about to gavel down 5 and 6 as having some support from the council. Items 5 and 6.
I understand the problem, and I think it was well articulated, and I've certainly heard from the community that the matching funds is totally unpopular, undoable, and nobody gets it, and I will accept that. I'm sorry, and I will just again reiterate that is a capacity building thing and an understanding that needs to be worked on if we're going to help organizations find funds other places that do require matching. I think we can just let it go. We should let and not worry about it any further. It was an experiment that appears not to have worked.
Well,
from my perspective,
at any rate,
that's an observation.
Perhaps an alternative approach to that would be to consider that a plus factor for the weighting. So instead of making a requirement, it could step down in significance and say, well, you get points if you
And that's a possibility. I think that's something I would leave to the committee. My opinion is, as a requirement, it was an experiment that didn't quite work.
Would you come up to the microphone?
Rex, we need to hear you. So could you come to the mic so we know what you asked?
He asked me to speak into the microphone.
Yeah, what I was saying is we can't quite hear Roger, so
sure.
If you could speak into the microphone, that would be better for us. Thank you.
That's great.
You're going to make
a
start again.
And just as a point of clarification, Councilmember Blair, you are talking about the proposal to not require matching at all. What the memo captures was the starting recommendation that we maintain the looser requirement that was in place
right.
today. So
and
I just want to make sure we know where we land.
Thank you. Okay. My suggestion is that we not worry about it anymore.
Okay.
If the committee two chairs would like to
She's
add that as a bonus,
yes.
then that's fine.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I am not. I'm denying it, actually. I'm not supporting
that's
it.
That's the clarification.
I get
not.
I'm sorry. Well, I'm
misunderstanding
what you're
right.
saying.
So
sorry.
I'll be more clear if
okay.
I can, and thank you for checking. In terms of the ability to award partial funding, it, to me, really definitely relates to the maximum award amount. I like the idea of an organization making a proposal that has some scalability, that's well articulated, because sometimes things, estimates, can be imprecise as much as there is a strong effort to make them precise. And I think scalability talks about how well that's understood. I think in terms of the maximum award, when we get to that, I would like to at least be able to consider making sure that we give more than one award.
If everybody's clear, is Ann alone on 6 and 5, or are there others who share her sentiments? Sarah?
With regards to 6, for me, when I think of partial funding, if it's scalable and you can choose, you know, we've had contracts come to us with options.
Mm-hmm.
If it's set up like that, to me that's not partial. It's what last year is we looked at how much money was being asked for, how much was available, and
it was
about 75%. Yeah, it was
okay.
Just cutting it down.
Okay.
So I don't have a problem at all with being scalable.
So it's still a project. It's funded at a lower level, but partial is the word that's misleading here.
And I don't like partial funding. I think scalable projects are important because it then makes it doable if the full amount is not available. But it has to be clearly identified that way, and
sounds
we have
like,
to give scores for that.
It sounds like number 6 is confusing. It's a matter of interpretation at this point.
Well,
so.
I think the point of clarification is that which I tried to capture at the outset, which is it's one thing to have a tiered approach that from which the grantor could select, but one of the proposal is, which I recommend, is eliminating just the committee on its own electing to award a smaller amount than was applied for, because sometimes that just...
As opposed to inviting the applicant to come back with a new proposal at a lower amount.
I
think the process that would work and that has worked in the past better is if on the application we solicit, would you like to suggest your, you know, your the funding request you're making? If less funding is available, are there, do you have the ability to scale this project, and if so, at what levels? What happens when you get into an iteration is it becomes very tricky, because in the past, sometimes the committee say has awarded half of the amount, or even gone one step further and said, we'll award this amount but for only these portions of the activities you proposed. And that puts the recipient in the position of saying, based on, you know what, I didn't have input to that, I had to then rewrite my scope, and I'm not sure this works for me. So this was intended to respond to that. I think we understand the feedback that you've given, and we can design the application so that it encourages people to give some of those landing options for the committee.
Everybody clear on that one? I am. Okay. And then on five, and objecting.
Four is the next one, I think, back to the...
No. I preemptively said, does anyone not support item five? And Ann said, I do not support item number five. And I'm looking now to see if there's...
As it's stated in the memo, which is a requirement.
Yeah, and my...
I do not support a requirement.
That's what it says. That's what I'm asking, not to rewrite it.
I would support... that, and I believe my co-chair would as well, moving that as a plus factor into the scoring criteria. And so, therefore, not agreeing with the mayor on the matching and moving that as a plus factor in the scoring.
Any objection to that recommendation? Mr. Bonkowski, does that sound like a workable solution?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'd let you know if I had a problem.
Oh. All right. Well, then let's go back to two, which now has a G in it, and not worry about how the 100 points are allocated, or not get into turning the amp up to 11 and have 110 points or something. Sarah.
So the trouble that I have with coming up with criteria and scoring it, and this is going to sound horrible since I'm the chair, it's never been really clear to me what the purpose of the funds are for, because I hear so many different things. Every different conversation I have, someone has a different idea.
The state.
So I'd like to hear from our attorney, if it's not putting him on the spot.
Unfortunately, the state law says quite
well,
clearly.
But everyone has a different opinion about the state law.
The purpose of the lodging tax is basically to promote tourism. The statute says that it may be used directly or indirectly by the municipality or through a convention and visitors bureau for tourism marketing, the marketing and operations of special events and festivals designed to attract tourists, supporting the operations and capital expenditures of tourism-related facilities owned by a city or by a public facilities district, supporting the operations of tourism-related facilities owned or operated by nonprofit organizations, certain types of nonprofits, 501c3s and 501c6s, and it also, I think there was some statement about the some question about the 50 miles earlier in the overnight stays. The statute encourages people, tourism that results in people traveling more than 50 miles or traveling from out of state and making overnight stays. It does that by requiring that every applicant provide estimates with their application of how any monies received will result in increases in the number of people traveling for business or pleasure away from their place of residence or business and staying overnight in paid accommodations to a place 50 miles or more away from their place of residence or business and from another country or state outside their place of business. And then it requires afterwards that each recipient provide you information saying how that worked out on those criteria. So that's what that number one criteria I think is intended to capture as well as, I believe, second criteria B. That's where those criteria, I think, came from when the deputy city manager and I discussed that last year. But those are the allowed purposes. It's really to promote tourism and overnight stays.
That answer your question? Or your
I thought it was important to hear that it's also about, I feel like there's an overemphasis sometimes on promoting the overnight stays and not on the other activities, the festivals and events.
Correct.
And I just needed to hear that.
Other comments on the criteria?
I would only add that you said we had a G, which I guess is the match.
Well, if we agree to move up the
right,
our matching funds.
You also had an assessment evaluation piece.
So we have a G and an H.
Okay.
For consideration, and I don't know, it's a little bit hard to do these kind of numbers on the fly necessarily, so I don't know if people want to do some thinking about those.
Roger, on the evaluation, that's a requirement of the proposal. So,
right, but I think it's different. I mean, I guess what the feedback that I was hearing is that some things are not quantifiable. Therefore, is it something that is measurable? Is that something we value? And I'm not necessarily saying it is, but that one of the complaints was that programs were funded and you couldn't tell if they worked it or not. So maybe you could report back, but if it's not measurable, whether it's effective or not, may be diminished.
Other comments? I'm confused as to whether that indeed is going to be part of the criteria or whether that is just part of the fabric of the process of approval.
My thought, and tell me if you think this is okay, Morgan, is that we do something like we did with the priority budgeting and that people maybe look at these factors and rank them on their own, and we can evaluate those and get something that makes sense. Does that work for our process?
You're suggesting that the council, we could send something out that showed the 7 or 8 criteria that are being proposed and solicit folks to give us their version of a 100-point spread?
Yes.
And then we'll take that? Great. We'll be happy to do that.
And then we have this is a big issue, too, is whether or not the city would be eligible. We have one.
I'm not there yet. We're still on item 2.
Yep.
I'm just, are we fine with the way Morgan has just talked about how to handle what we've just done? Mr. Tollison?
Maybe this is off the point, but on item E, there was a public comment related to that, and I don't read that as meaning that somebody has to have successfully had a program like they're proposing before. It's simply that they have to be a real organization.
I would agree with that interpretation of E. I think E is appropriate.
Other comments on these? Have you heard enough on number 2, Morgan, to go forward?
Yes.
Well, let's go to number 3, maximum award amount.
And could I insert, just as a frame of reference, as you're thinking about number 3, that the current, last year's prior RFP set a $2,000 minimum, so there were no awards smaller than that, which you might want to consider whether that minimum works for you or not. And a $50,000 maximum.
For last year. And you are now suggesting the maximum award be limited to 15, not 50.
Well, I am not suggesting that. I want to be clear.
Who is we?
This memo captures the chair and co-chair's thinking, but I want to point out that the reason that $15,000 number emerged was, as it says here, to respond to some very specific feedback from recipient groups in the community.
Who shall remain unnamed.
Well, and why that, what, well.
Comments on this? Mr. Ward.
I would be in favor of
no minimum or maximum amount and no fewer than two drivers on.
Oh, yeah, okay. It's rubbing off from Roger.
Go ahead, sit, repeat.
I'll repeat. I would be in favor of simplifying this and saying that there's no minimum or maximum amount other than the dollars available, and no fewer than two grants will be awarded.
For example, or specifically? Two isn't. Is two
words,
have some. You have rationale
words,
for.
No one group is going to get the full amount.
Exactly.
That's what you.
Yeah.
Which might be stated better.
I would agree.
Yeah, as opposed to quantifying the number of grants. Other comments, Sarah.
Well, so what I saw last year, and I wasn't part of the decision making, was you had a few organizations that requested a lot of money, and you had some smaller organizations that were doing events. And the larger ones were, you know, primarily, you know, the Lodging Association, and the Chamber and BIDA, you know, marketing. But you had some smaller organizations who have started events or trying to get going, the Bluegrass Festival, the Quilt Festival. And my concern is that if you don't either have a, you know, if we don't require the proposals to be scalable, or we don't have a maximum amount, that those smaller organizations that I think are important are going to get left out. And, you know, I remember I brought up at the meeting last year, you know, the Quilt Festival was applying for money, and it's something that's new. It's not huge yet, but if you look down at Sisters Oregon, you cannot stay anywhere near Sisters Oregon during that Quilt Festival. And it's something that has the possibility of growing into something very big that I think that in my mind these funds should be supporting. But if you have kind of a few organizations grabbing it all, for me that's not how it's supposed to work.
But isn't that, I mean, looking back at the scoring again, I mean, isn't that what the scoring is all about? I mean, obviously how you interpret it is subjective, but if the Quilt Festival has, you know, an enthusiastic advocate on the committee that, you know, I mean, I agree with you. I think that something like that is absolutely where you'd want it to go, but I wonder why this doesn't work for that.
Well, that's why it kind of is all linked together. If you're not going to allow partial awards and say the Quilt Festival, you know, is at the top and they're only requesting a small amount of money, and now maybe you don't have enough money left to give full awards to everybody else. So that's why I just think it's really important that, well, it will be for me and my scoring maybe, that projects are scalable.
I think we have Ms. Blair and then Mr. Ponkowski.
Thank you. I would like a maximum. I think it needs to be a healthy maximum. And I would, because it's a nice number, and that's exactly how prejudiced I am, I have no clue or reason other than it works for me, and that is I would put a maximum of $75,000. That is a bucket load of money to infuse at one moment to a project. That could be to a single organization or to a collaborative one. It also then doesn't make it, I mean, it leaves the opportunity, certainly, for, it would mean we would do more than one project with the funds. It could be more than one. I mean, it could be more than two, but I would certainly put a cap on that. And I think it needs to be substantial enough to make it worthwhile and to really have an impact. I think it also helps to have a minimum, because it is quite something to administer a project with lots and lots of little ones. And I think it's reasonable to ask a group to think about, even no matter what the project is, but to put it at a $2,500 minimum. So those would be the two ranges I would put. And then the committee would work on it. I also like the idea of scalability, but that, talking about the maximum award amount, I would recommend that we have a maximum and it not be the full amount, because I do want there to be an option, but I also want it to be something that people are encouraged to come together and make a substantial proposal.
Mr.
Well, I think one of the issues that you deal with, and let's the quilt was a good example. If the quilt organization had gone out into the lodging organization and had an endorsement or some kind of relationship that says, I'm doing this, and it's a new thing, and it's associated with lodging or with some other organization so that you get the connection to the rest of the community, I think you get points for that. Because if you don't, anything new, if you look at the scale that you currently are looking at, you're going to get zero for E and zero for F. So you're going to be maxed out at 80. If you had the best project out there, but it's a new project, you're not going to get more than 80 points. So somehow you've got to figure out, you know, part of working your project so that it maximizes the points, even small ones.
Mr. Ward.
I think what Sarah says has a lot of merit, and I'm also not trying to complicate things, but does it make sense to consider taking $20,000 of this and making it available to three or four grants for event-specific things, like a bluegrass festival or a quilt show, and then the balance of it would be more on target based on our criteria?
Townsend.
My thought would be that we should encapsulate all whatever the values we have for this within the scoring, and to go back to Mr. Tollefson's point is just let's try to encapsulate the things that we value that are consistent with the statute within the criteria, and if it's this is something that's scalable. I pause a little bit on that word because I think that word can mean a lot of different things. But something that is, maybe that seeds future. I mean, I don't know what that is, but I would rather than create an arbitrary hard line, bake all these into the scoring criteria.
Reflecting on some of the comments we heard earlier, I wonder, rather than naming a minimum or maximum, whether it might be expressed as a percentage. We heard the lodging representative talk about if this works, we'll have 250,000, and I wonder if no more than 60% of the fund and no less than X amount of the fund, which would have some guidance, but will allow for the, once we know what the dollars are, now you know what your maximums are, as opposed to we have a bad year and we collect $60,000.
Right.
As Councilmember Blair was noting, we change it every year. The other thing is, remember, this is for a document that would be given to the proposers to help guide them in developing their project. And so I think having a knowledge about what dollar target...
Well, no, it would be said in the document. This is a policy issue, and what the council's saying is no more than 75% fund, let's say, or 60%.
Which equals X dollars.
Yes, and then that would be given to the applicants, as opposed to putting a dollar amount. Just a suggestion.
Yeah.
It appears this one, there is some uncertainty as to it's, that we'd like to see something more, set-asides, et cetera. I don't think we could come to an agreement exactly how this would be worded, but I do think there's some sense of more flexibility in terms of maximum and minimums.
Well, and I have a question for Ann on that, which is your point was $2,500 and $75,000, which is fairly similar to what, but just bumping the 50 to 75, would something that is sort of 50% of the cap, would that make sense? And no single grant could get more than 50%?
I mean, I think that's fine. I mean, however it needs to be stated to make it work. I think I hear that it's difficult to do an effective marketing campaign.
Yes.
And I think that I'm remembering that some years that's exactly what we've said. I mean, there have been years in times past where we put put it all into a collaborative marketing effort.
and other years where we've said we will put it all in, you know, or the maximum is this, and other times when we, I mean, that's the advantage to doing it each year. It changes, it may be, and I think it is difficult for organizations, but it does leave a variety of approaches happening over the course of a 10-year period. So you've heard my opinion, and I'm happy to support the way it works for the whole council.
I would argue against revisiting this every year. You'll never have any baseline. You'll never have any metric about what works or don't work. I think you set up some kind of, you address these 6 points. You say, we're going to try this for the next 3 rounds. And not that we couldn't make an adjustment where it's, but I think coming back every year, if I were an applicant, I'd be in this room every year thinking, now what's it going to be? What's it going to be?
They are.
And I think we owe it to say, here it is. This is how we want to do it. And again, not making them so tight they're inflexible, but saying we're going to go with these. That's my opinion on this. I don't think you need to respond specifically to that.
I won't.
Unless there's a mandate to do it annually.
No, I think I think it is good practice for us to bring it forward for council discussion every year.
Yes.
Because it lets us illuminate some of the challenges and agree by consensus that you have these priorities for this year. It would be great if we could lengthen our horizon and have consistent priorities from year to year. That certainly makes it a challenge for the proposers. But as a perfect example, this question of what a maximum award should be, there is a constituency out there that believes that many smaller awards is a correct use of or a preferable use of the funds. There's a constituency you've heard from tonight that believes that fewer projects at a larger scale is an appropriate use. That is part of what leads to the needle moving around from year to year, because there's validity in both perspectives.
Well, at some point, we can't come back every year and say the needle's moving. We're never going to get it right. That's my frustration with this. Let's talk about number 4, because number 4 has a lot to do with number 3. And it's certainly, let me just speak from my own experience. There was a reference to the King County tax and the money that was used for, say, the Folklife Festival and for things like this. I think they even built a stadium or something with that money. But the city has a hand in this, and so at least one member, I think it was Mr. Bonkowski, has expressed an opposition to number 4. Let's talk about that. Mr. Ward.
Well, I couldn't support number 4. I don't think the city has any appropriate role in this.
Okay. Other succinct.
I think that it's hard to know whether the city has an appropriate role or not unless until you have the proposal in front of you. I see that it's problematic in terms of perception and conflict and all that, but you know, if the city comes up with a gangbuster project and this is an appropriate source of funding because it meets all the criteria, I'd like to see the project before you make that decision.
That's been my position, is that, you know, if the city prevails on the criteria, then it should rise to the top, and if it doesn't, then it should fail. I'm curious what the learning experience or the lessons learned was from the Folklife type example. I mean, the stadium example is obviously the a hot button one, but Folklife certainly sounds like a success.
I partially bring this up in responding to Sarah's comments, where there may be a number of smaller events which would attract tourism, be they musical or quilt or whatever, that maybe could be leveraged through the city's own outreach and community coordination activities in a way that a bigger bang for some of the dollars if the city were coordinating. This is just all off the top of my head, but it would otherwise, to the extent it's a small one-time bluegrass festival or a one-time, it's hard to get an organization up and rolling to get those kinds of competitive grants in, I would guess. So just a thought.
Yep.
Steve.
My issue is, look, if we want to do that, that's great. then we also need to take general fund dollars and tell the city to prepare proposals. I mean, the proposals aren't free. You have to spend time, you have to spend money to do that. You know, we don't have a community program director as a funded position for tourism.
Well, it was just an example.
As a member of staff.
I understand.
Okay, so if we wanted, if we were serious about getting the city to submit a tourism proposal, then out of our general fund, we have to authorize an expenditure of, you know, however many thousands of dollars and tell the city manager this is a new thing we want the city manager to go do, to make a proposal to compete in LTAC. Either that, or you set a certain amount of money aside, and you say, okay, this is the money that we're going to spend on LTAC funds with whatever the restrictions are on LTAC funds, and then the city needs to have other funds in order to execute that or whatever. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do it,
yeah.
But it's not the same as the nonprofits coming in to ask for grant funds. And that's the reason I don't support it.
Yeah, it doesn't say the city must. It just says the city's eligible. And it seems to me it's another one of those longer-range things where certainly we can know if the city intends. It's an opportunity. I'm not an advocate for or against. I'm just trying to enrich the discussion a bit. Sarah?
Well, and I agree. Especially if we're not going to revisit this every year. I mean, I don't have a problem saying now that at some point in the future there might be something. I can't think of anything.
No.
The city might, you know, want to apply for these funds. I don't have a problem saying now, you know, let's have that be a possibility in the future. Because,
mm-hmm.
Like Wayne said, it's not saying we're not looking to come up with something. It's if something comes along some year, sometime.
Well, for example, the city could fund the 4th of July. I mean, that's an event that's a city event. The city could fund 4th of July, and we could take the LTAC funds to go do that. There are lots of events that the city could decide that it wants to go and fund. But to do that, we would then need to have that as part of the work plan for the city. And right now, it's not there. And I think that as we move forward in looking at different kinds of economic development and how the city is engaging itself in economic development, I think there might be a time where you want to revisit that. You know, you look at Port Townsend and they take, if not all, a majority of the funds in order for their boat school and all the things that they do out at Port Townsend. But that's, you know, I mean, that is managed by the city in a big way. We don't have that yet because we haven't moved into that arena in terms of economic development and what that means in terms of the city's involvement, the city staff, and the commitment of funds to go do that.
We have two council members who've spoken against leaving this one in. Are there the others who would join with them, or do we have a kind of split council guidance here?
Well, unfortunately, I think the dilemma with leaving it split is that, as Councilmember Bonkowski points out, in order for us to move forward on our schedule, there would be an activity that would involve somebody on the city staff investing the energy to develop a proposal to come forward for your consideration in the next 4 to 5 weeks, so that could be developed in time to actually submit a proposal. So what I think we were hoping to understand here is that work that you would like the city to begin?
No, my position on this is that I don't view it as my job to direct any individual department to organize their staff the way they want. I view this as a, you know, doctrinal policy against doing this, and I don't have that. And what I heard the majority of people saying is that they were open to it, they just couldn't think of a good reason for it. So I think the majority of people think cities should submit, you should be eligible to be
eligible,
but to be eligible, but not a direction saying that we want a devote, you know, we wanted this to be a priority or we want the city to devote resources to that.
Ms. Blair is next, and then Mr. Tollefson.
To the contrary, if you're reading this as kind of an invitation that you should go out and scout a proposal, then I'd vote against it.
Yeah, me too.
Because I think that this is kind of looking to the future for some, boy, we never thought of something like this before, and this is a unique opportunity for the city.
And Mike, I think then I like having it here as an option. And that's, and particularly, I mean, as a possibility, I agree that this is not something we're saying as a result of having it as an option that ought to be done. I am so aware of how much we cannot and have been trying very hard over the year to discipline ourselves against suddenly coming up with a new work option and a new piece of work this year. I see this as something that has to do with our economic development work plan, and if we want to, as part of economic development, actively promote tourism and want our city government to take an active role in it, one of the ways we do it is by direct, is by the allocation of LTAC. We may want a very specific active role in that. I think that should come forward as part of an annual work plan, and we don't have it right now. I like having this here as an option, but I do not think that I've seen anything that says add something more. And we should think about it, and now we have people certainly on our staff with the promotion and marketing look. There may be something that's very obvious that can come forward next year as part of the work plan. But I would encourage, so I like having the city eligible to be considered if it's real. But I appreciate the idea also of doing it that the city is competitive as opposed to taking a slice off the top.
Yes.
So I think that's a helpful thing to do.
That's a change in the state
exactly.
of law I wanted to highlight.
Yes.
Previously the city could unilaterally decide
exactly.
to reserve its funding for its own purposes, and as of last summer that's no longer permitted. The city's proposal will go in the hopper with every other proposal.
Right. That's how I read this.
And that's state law.
Yes, correct.
Any further guidance from us on this topic?
I want to add one more point that reflects some comments that I heard from the public, which was getting the word out and soliciting RFPs and maybe emailing people that have applied in the past or feeling like, and this is a constant issue that we deal with, is how much notice to give. But again, I just want to reflect that I heard that feedback is people not necessarily knowing the schedule. I know you've told me the schedule many times, but and it's out there, but just to make sure that's part of our communication track.
Yep, and just as a chance to highlight, we're aiming to issue the RFP if we stay on track by September 1. So hopefully that's where we'll land. We'll come back to you in August with hopefully a close to final version for you to look at.
Thank you.
Yeah,
let's move to...
Excuse me.
Steve, I'm sorry.
One other comment. Based on last year, I would encourage you to start looking for the people that are going to serve on the committee now, because the reason that it got to be so late and we didn't have orientations and a bunch of other things is we had a very difficult time filling the requirements of the committee. Okay.
And I think we have some good names already, but we could get more names.
You're going to need to recruit.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. If that does it. Next item, moving the meeting date.
Jim is leaving in about 10 minutes since his last meeting.
Oh, well, would you like to say something now?
Yeah.
Mr. Schultz wishes to.
Okay. Our city attorney is going to be leaving here to catch the ferry shortly, and this is his last meeting with us before we have our staff attorney attending. So I would like to thank Jim for the work he's done in helping staff, guiding us, and in providing very sage advice. making our job a lot easier.
You're here. Thank you.
Thank you. If I could just say that it's been my pleasure to be here. You guys have a great staff, a great city manager. It's been my pleasure to work with them over the course of time. The city council gets along well together, at least as much as I can observe in public, and that's a very good plus for the community. And so it really has been my pleasure to be here for the last 18 months, and I wish you all the best as you move into having your staff attorney present. I will still be working on some matters for the city just as we transition, and I'm always available for anything you need me for. So I hope we'll get a chance to work together again in the future. Thank you for all your confidence and support.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. All right, now, item 4F, changing of the city council meeting date. Moving it to the consent agenda for July 28th. Mr. Tollison.
I move the city council schedule ordinance number 2014-30 related to the meeting date of the regular meeting of July 28th, 2014 consent agenda.
Second. Moved and seconded. Any discussion on the date of Tuesdays beginning in September? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No. Thank you. All right, we have now the item sign ordinance. Sign ordinance, I'm just bringing it up, yeah. Slash tent signs, or I'm sorry, sandwich boards. And I think Mr. Bonkowski has asked that this be put on the agenda, so I'll ask him to open up the discussion.
Yep. Recently, there's been a number of people that have commented about the proliferation of sandwich boards, as well as some trees on that are advertising on public land. I don't want to talk about the trees that are advertising on public land. I'm going to save that for another discussion, but the sandwich boards, I think, is getting to be a at least for me, it is a. There are a lot more than I ever envisioned possible, and it's almost as if we're deforesting the island to make sandwich boards. It appears that there are two different varieties. In terms of sandwich boards, ones that are advertising come on in, and others that are kind of directing where businesses are. And so I think when we talked about the use of the public sidewalks, we kicked the whole issue of signage at the end of, I forget, Doug, was it August or September or late fall? Something like that.
Right.
And I think based on where we are today, I thought it might be appropriate to have a conversation to see if there's anything that, if that's a unique view that I and a couple other people have, or if that's a broader view that we should do something about. And so along those lines.
Okay. So a couple different approaches that I could suggest. One would be to revisit the ordinance and look at the regulatory aspect of it. We've had the code compliance officer out twice now to count the number of signs and identify violations. Last Friday, there were roughly 43 signs, I believe it was, and two violations. Those two violations, if I recall correctly, were multiple signs off-site. The second
survey
was that just today. Down in Winslow?
Or that was that? Yes, that was just down Winslow Way.
Okay.
From Madison to 305. So yeah, and we know there are signs in other
High
areas.
High School Road and
yep, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
And then today, the same area, there were 39 signs and again two violations. So it doesn't look like it's a matter of people not complying with the current ordinance. It looks like it's just what the ordinance currently allows. So a lot of cities in the past 7-8 years during the economic downturn allowed sandwich board signs, allowed businesses a little more latitude in advertising, but I think now that the economy has started to pick up a little bit, you know, we still want to work with the businesses to try to identify solutions, and just to provide the council with some examples of what some cities have done, I put together a couple slides here. This just shows some wayfinding options that a couple cities have done here. I believe the one on the left hand side is actually Seattle, and the other one is from Philadelphia. And then this on the left again is Seattle waterfront sign, and you can see some other cities have taken a less uniform approach, I guess you might say, in their creativity for wayfinding signs. So what I would suggest is that we take a look at the ordinance, but also at the same time have a parallel effort that we're working with the businesses to try to find some solutions that can work for the businesses as well, rather than just looking at eliminating the signage.
Doug, when you look at these, the difference between the fancy sign on the left and the previous two and the one on the right is they're not advertising any businesses at all.
Right.
Whereas the one on the right that, you know, you have the tack up to telephone poles are advertising businesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think the city has any sandwich boards.
No.
So I think the sandwich boards are all associated with businesses. And so how we go about dealing with that in an environment that is better than tacking it up on telephone poles or sandwich boards. You know, are you familiar with any places that have done that sort of thing?
Yeah. If you look at the Seattle waterfront, there are signs that direct to businesses. And these types of signage could certainly be modified. You know, the Philadelphia sign here, you could actually insert these plaques for individual businesses. There's nothing that would prohibit that. Our wayfinding signs have maps that show where specific businesses are located. And I was, you know, that would be the type of signage for uniformity, at least in the Winslow area, that we'd want to maintain consistency, but have it modified a little bit so that it's more of a wayfinding sign that could be used to advertise businesses where they would potentially pay for the plaque themselves. And it, obviously we'd want something designed so that the individual plaques can be moved as businesses change, but you know, this is something we'd want to open up a conversation with the business community about.
Is there any chance of impacting anything for this summer, in your opinion?
I think that'd be pretty difficult to get something constructed and installed that quickly, but I think certainly for next summer it's a reasonable time frame.
Does this ordinance affect the city, what the city can do, or what the commercial? I mean, we're talking about the commercial stuff, and these I'm throwing a little bit because these examples seem like city examples, and the comment up here was that using utility poles would make sense, perhaps. But is there a law against that, or it seems like this might be a utility pole right here in this example.
So the utility poles, most of them are owned by Puget Sound Energy. Sure. So if we were going to hang something on them, we would want to enter into an agreement with them so that we were.
Sure. So that is potentially doable.
We haven't had the conversation with Puget Sound Energy, but there's an example there that someone has done it.
I mean, that's the other ugly element of Winslow Way that's kind of left over from not burying the utilities, and there's a way to solve one problem and mask the other one a little bit. I think that's got some appeal to it.
It appears to me that the sandwich boards are doing two things, which is a bit what I think you were aiming at, Steve, as a question. One of them is to say, hey, here's where our store lives, and we need something that tells people this is the store, not necessarily something that says, it's as simple as we have no sign, we don't have signs without neon or whatever. We don't, but some cities will have very straightforward uniform, they can be artistic, could go with the theme, whatever, that hang down from an overhang or come out from a store door that identifies what store is where it is. So that as you walk along, you can identify if that's, to me, that's a question to discuss with the merchants and learn what they want to have happen. I mean, obviously the point is get the customers in the door. Well, it's pretty tricky if that's the objective. Is there a way to do that and to not obstruct the sidewalk? If the problem they're faced with is that we have something here, either cost-wise or by design, or by regulation that prohibits them from having a sign that says who they are. Is that what they're trying to accomplish? I don't know that we know that. We're guessing, and I think that's why we need their advice.
So some of the signs are actually directing people to businesses that aren't on Winslow Way. That's one of the needs that
I
hear from
businesses.
Okay, so
that's an additional need.
Right. There are certainly some businesses that put their sandwich board sign out on the sidewalk in front of their business. I don't know if that's just they're trying to attract drive-by traffic that wouldn't otherwise be looking to see their shop.
Well, they may also be saying, gosh, everybody else has a sandwich board, I better have one too.
Yeah.
So I think it's a conversation that is certainly important to talk to the merchants, and I would suspect that both the Chamber and BIDA are the two groups that convene those conversations and would be important to talk with and learn from.
Yeah.
Sarah.
Is a shorter term solution, is it possible to limit the sandwich boards on Winslow Way to those that are providing direction to businesses that don't have a Winslow Way storefront? Or is that not, can we allow some businesses to do it and not others?
Because they're tacky. What are we trying to
accomplish? Well, because I think it's important for the businesses off Winslow Way.
Right.
I mean that all makes sense, but I guess what
and,
I think
and
is
so
that
until,
what we
I mean,
want
I think something like this, these is a good idea, but I don't think it's possible to do it for this summer. So I'm wondering if in the short term, do you limit the signs that are out there? Can we say, businesses that aren't on Winslow Way, we will allow you to put up a directional sign?
I think we'd have a little bit of difficulty singling out businesses that way, allowing one but not another. And I think just the process, because this will require public hearings, so I think just the process itself of amending the ordinance is going to put us at the very end of the summer at the earliest.
I just have a couple observations. One is, I know when we talked about signage on the cafes, we limited products that attract that are unlawful to minors, and I didn't see that here, and I wanted to know if that's the case here. So could you have a buy your marijuana here sign? And I would think that would be something that we would, which is not okay on the cafes. And I would think that we want to echo that here.
I believe state law prohibits that. I can check on that though.
Okay. And then the other thing is that it seems to me that that it makes a big difference. I mean, you see a lot on high school. You see some up on Day Road. You see the Strawberry Farm might make sense to have four signs to go to the Strawberry Farm, but it wouldn't make sense to have four signs Winslow Way. I think we're solving different problems in different places. So this seems to me maybe is really a Winslow Way problem. So I wonder whether we want to limit the scope to Winslow narrowly, or at least view them differently. I think we had another comment, but...
Well, I think those are the types of things we would come back with. If the council consensus is you want to take the approach of looking at the ordinance and doing this, then we'll start working on putting that discussion together so that we bring it back as quickly as possible. I don't think we're in a position to try to craft what it would be tonight.
Good. Okay.
The not to be a sign engineer, because we've all been road engineers, so I'm going to volunteer to be a sign engineer, but it would appear to me that if you were to restrict for the city to say that you can have a directional sign only to your place of business, and it will be on a utility pole, and we go and approach the utility company and say that's all right, and we define what that structure is, and then outlaw all of the sandwich boards, that my guess is the businesses very quickly will figure out, if we say it's got to be 6 inches by 18 inches, and you can hang it in these locations, that very quickly you'd have a new way of having business.
Okay, sign engineering.
Sign engineering.
Any other things for discussion here besides engineering? Comment? Well, let's hear from...
No, I think Eric is fine.
Didn't know this was coming up. My name is Eric Fredericks, 7776 Yomo, and I'm one of the owners of the Pavilion. So, I see sandwich boards up and down Madison all the time. I would like you guys to do something. You'd have my support to do something about it. It's way too much, and it's going to get out of control. So a couple of my tenants now have signs, because I think they need to, down on the corner of Winslow Way in Madison to
yes.
direct people up to the Pavilion. But that's because we don't have what you just took the slide away that Ann was talking about, a waypoint sign that says the Pavilion and more shops are up there. And as we point out to Jerry, the newcomer at Vita, the Pavilion's part of downtown too. And we would like that to be communicated in the winter with Christmas lights going up Madison. We'd like it to be communicated in the summer with waypoint signs that say movies, restaurants. But what we don't want to see is lacking that in a coordinated sign that we have signboards everywhere. There's too much, in my opinion, they're dangerous. Their sidewalks aren't wide enough to begin with, and it's really rude.
Thank you. Ms. Lester?
First, I would like to thank our city manager for bringing forward some creative ideas, and certainly the wayfinding is part of a potential solution. So thank you very much. The one thing I wanted to point out is that the waypoint, there's been a sign there again. The sign is placed at the waypoint. And the waypoint, specifically having served on the Citizens Task Force, they were very specific about no banners, no signage, no advertisement, and there is yet again a sign that is at the waypoint. The waypoint didn't allow the frogs to be there, again, it was, this is a very clean, aesthetic, welcoming space, and we do not want to clutter it. So if anything, please have that sign removed that's at the waypoint. If I understand correctly, our signed ordinance, and this was a very challenging to find our Bainbridge Island Municipal Code on our website, which I would suggest that we have a very clear link, and Val saying it's not, but I will double, I'll show you the pathway I took, but I found it, but it says not adjacent, that the signage has to be adjacent to the property, and to have signs that are 3 and 4 blocks away, I don't think follow our ordinance. We spent a lot of money on our landscaping, and now our landscaping is being smashed by the signboards that are being placed in our landscaping on Winslow Way. So I would say that you can't be putting them on top of our plants that we installed. And then lastly, I do appreciate that they went out and counted and have found that there are redundant signs, because if I read the ordinance correctly, you're only allowed one. And I think that's it. So thank you very much. I really appreciate you putting this on the agenda and bringing it to the attention. I guess the last thing is the very large signs that are 5x5 planter box with Virginia Mason on them. And it's part of an advertising campaign, and personally, I do not see that our public streets should be used for that kind of advertising marketing campaign, but that may be for a later conversation. They're up through August, and so I guess Harborview or the Doctor's Clinic or others who want to be as creative and get around our sign ordinance can develop planters and plaster their name on the front of the planters. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm surprised no one's mentioned here that we have a directory at the terminal and one in front of Columbia Bank, which are updated, which list business, which I've directed many a tourist to find where food or clothing or which I think is already, and they're beautiful. I mean, I think they're very attractive, and
they were paid for with LTAC dollars.
So we have some solutions, I think, already going, and I would just, my two cents would be the number of, there's always been old Winslow Way, new Winslow Way, there's always been some sandwich board somewhere. But it is this thing about everybody's got one out. I need one too, and it has gotten to be, the game is to find a business without one. And when Maura put a sign up, just as for example, I thought, now here's a destination business. There are many people come over to have the ice cream, and I thought, this is interesting that they apparently think their business is enhanced by this. And I'm thinking mostly it's because everybody has a sign out, because up to that point I had not seen a directory for ice cream at their store. So just an observation. All right, there we are. We're not going to get anything done.
Except that did we give direction in any way? What the next step is? Does Doug?
Well, enforce the ordinance, including the violators, removing redundant signs, I think we hear, and you're going to bring something to us by at least September, perhaps, end of summer.
Yeah, and I'll also start communicating with the business community to try to pull them together to have a discussion about options.
Yeah, that would be good.
Doug, does the term adjacent mean much of anything in this context?
Oh, yeah. Adjacent definitely has a enforcement mechanism behind it.
Okay, because there's a number of them that don't appear to meet that requirement. So. But I'm not the code enforcement officer, fortunately.
I think there are off-premise signs allowed as part of the code, and that's what is happening. In particular, the Mora sign followed
Gelardo sign directing people down.
Go left, no, go straight.
Right.
Yes. All right. Committee reports, item six. Any two bring to us? All right. I will just comment that I attended a meeting of the Leadership Alliance Against Coal meeting last week. It's not a committee, but I did attend it at some point in the future. I'll have some sort of report about the discussion. This was sponsored by King County and the City of Seattle and had representatives from all over the Northwest attending to talk about trains, both oil and coal bearing long trains and the impact on communities. I thought it was an interesting meeting and very educational, really. Review of upcoming council meetings. Mr. Schultz.
Okay, next week we have an executive session scheduled for 6:30. That's to review qualifications of an applicant for city employment. We will potentially need to move that to a different meeting, but stand by. We're waiting on applicants for the LTAC, and at this point we don't have a sufficient number of applications submitted. So we're trying to recruit people, but hopefully tonight's discussion will help move that along. We also have the first reading on Ordinance 2014-14. This is the temporary commercial parking, which is currently under a temporary ordinance for temporary commercial parking, and that temporary ordinance is scheduled to expire coming up relatively soon, so we have to have the permanent regulations in place. We also will, under unfinished business, the police oversight recommendations will be brought forward and presented to the City Council. And then we have a number of items on the consent agenda, mostly vouchers and meeting minutes, and then the two items that were forwarded to consent from this evening.
I would like to go ahead.
McCorn.
Well, I have two things that, because of the length of the meeting and then looking ahead, they might be appropriate study session things, but they may fit just time-wise, so I'd like to discuss that. One is there's a proposal for a change in the scope of work on a surfboard grant funding to deal with Springbrook Creek, and that is something that will require council action. And it seems, and there is also a timeline, deadline on that, because it has to do with a grant application. So I would like to have that brought up if the 28th is an appropriate place. And I'm really looking to Doug to guide that placement.
Where are you picking that off from?
If there's nothing here, it's new. It's because it has come up as a change. It's a scope of work question.
Okay.
And a way of doing our grant application that will require, it's a policy change. So it needs to, I think the council should discuss it. If this is the place to do it, there's more time, that one.
Yeah, and that's something from our discussion earlier today. I talked with the Public Works Director about, and he was going to check with his staff to find out if they could have that ready for the agenda.
Okay.
That's the question right now.
Okay. And the other one has to do with the Core 440 project, you know, that we had talked about, that Steve has brought up and wanting. Again, it's something, these are both appropriate for a study session conversation.
But the timing
is an issue for mm-hmm. them, and the time that's available, because sometimes our study sessions can be lengthy, and
so
this happens to be a little.
Week.
So that's my question. Is that what you want to do? Steve has asked a couple of times to have something where we can talk about those projects that are a part of the non-motorized.
Oh, the bond.
Well,
that's an approach.
It's the concept of,
Let's try to avoid...
That is actually...
I couldn't find it. That's the reason.
It should be somewhere in...
We couldn't find it earlier, picture. And that's why I mean, Steve and I were sitting here looking for it as that non-motorized conversation came up. David has a question or a comment.
I may be splitting hairs here. Does that discussion need to take place in the Transportation Benefit District meeting or in the council meeting?
One could lead to the next.
Okay, I just...
It's on my calendar in my office. But yeah, we've got that
next week.
I think it's not next week, but I'll check to see if we can get it.
But if it could
ready
be
for next week,
if that were reasonable, it's easier to try to balance the time commitment. But we also have what, two people missing next week?
Yes.
And are you one of those?
No, I'm not.
Oh, Roger is, and David? I don't mean to be playing foul. Okay, because you're non-motorized. What I want to make sure is people that have been working the non-motorized, it seems wise to make sure that people that participate in those committees as liaisons, that they're here if at all possible.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Before we leave this, with respect to the police recommendation, can you make sure that it covers the recommendation and how that relates to the Sam Pelko report and the Pendleton reports? So that, both of those had recommendations on what we should do in the police department. And so if we're going to come forward with the study associated with, oversight or whatever, I think it'd be appropriate that those be part of that presentation and where we fit within.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Mark, future meetings, other items?
I also didn't see SWIM. We talked about SWIM. Is it on here and I just missed it?
It is on there somewhere. I brought it up with Doug at our meeting. Where is it?
But I don't see it.
No, the policy revision revisited is on here somewhere. Did it fall off? Let's see. We specifically talked about this. No, it wouldn't be in October.
I think there might be some things that didn't get...
That may not have traveled well.
All right.
So we'll be meeting,
I think, Manana. Tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think staff is planning to bring that forward on the 4th. I see that it's not on the version of the calendar, but, Doug, I think you and Ellen had discussed that
I recall
timing.
Doug and I talked about it date specific.
Okay. So we'll be looking at these things, and you may get a revised look after tomorrow's conversation.
And then some update on the waterfront park. Or is that just
I can give you an update right now. We're still waiting to give the presentation to RCO. That happens next month.
Okay, so there.
So nothing has happened since the last discussion. We went through a trial run of the presentation, and then the next thing is we actually go down to Olympia and give a presentation in person. That happens in August.
And the process is we're going to wait until the grant, we get the information on the grant before we proceed to find the architectural firm to complete the design. Is that the idea?
I think that's probably the best best thing to do is wait until we hear about the grant status, and then we can decide how to proceed and what the scope of that project would be.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anything for the good of the order? We're adjourned.